Even if we do something wrong and we know we're doing something wrong, don't we attempt to rationalize it in our own mind and to our friends to justify what we're doing? So I believe it's a great fallacy to set out to brand those whom we disagree with as being evil people. The result of their actions we may perceive to be evil. We may perceive it to be bad. But I guarantee you those people don't see it that way. And when we present ourselves to them in that light, we're good and they're evil, do you think we have a chance of getting them to listen to us? Not on your life.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. The show even little Tim Pot radio station called Bristol Community FM didn't dare to transmit during the lockdown for fear of Ofcom. But it's strange, isn't it? Because all of the mass media was transmitting advice saying, let's move all of our sick people out of hospital and into care homes without testing them to see if they've got COVID. And tens of thousands of people possibly died as a result of that decision, a decision that we on this programme were not allowed to criticise. Anyway, I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news in an hour or so's time is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. We'll be looking at the Biden election, talking to journalist George Samueli, who writes for RT, about what Biden will mean for Europe and the rest of the world. Will we see wars beginning to break out again as they were before Trump? And what will Biden mean for the Iran nuclear deal? Most importantly, the only piece of paper standing between us and an Iran-Israel war, maybe even Armageddon. Also, the Hong Kong legislators resigned en masse this week, much to the consternation of China, although I thought that Beijing wanted them all gone. And Princess Diana, her amazing panorama interview from 25 years ago, the Palace managed to spin it this week as a story about how terrible the now BBC head of religious broadcasting, Martin Bashir, is and was. Never missing an opportunity for a vendetta, the Palace. And will the new Director General of the BBC, Tim Davey, do the right thing and defend Martin for doing his job back in 1995 in interviewing the Princess? And after The Traitors of Arnhem last week, the publication of another book of mine, which was commissioned and paid for, this time by Triny Day over in Oregon, but not published. Here for free, as of tonight, on PDF, my look at the occult war on God and on us all through some of the best articles I wrote for RT, including The Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy. Well, a big inverted commas around democracy, eh? My second book in 2 weeks, free, watermarked on PDF, is entitled The Siege of Heaven. And it's tied in closely with the occupation of true spirituality and religion over thousands of years. So I'll be publishing that tonight as a PDF. Anton Chaitkin rounds off proceedings later, appropriately, with a look at the origins of Pentecostalism and the charismatic movement and the mind control programs of the CIA and the Tavistock Institute. And before you say, who is Anton Chaitkin? What does he know? He's the son of Jacob Chaitkin, who was the chief strategist and lawyer for the American boycott of Nazi Germany, no less. An interesting son and an interesting father. But we start tonight with a panel discussion on the current unprecedented smashing of our rights to work, meet, demonstrate, rally, visit elderly relatives, sit next to our loved ones and hold their hands. That is the lockdown and lockdown light. The government and parliament seem to have forgotten the provisions in the March lockdown guaranteeing the right to protest, which were taken advantage of by Black Lives Matter, Extinction Rebellion and the anti-lockdown protesters back then. But they have now halted protests during November's lockdown light, including one that's scheduled to take place tomorrow in College Green in Bristol, that the police have banned. Of course, protests can't be banned if you believe in human rights. And also we'll be doing a report on last Saturday's protests over in Stroud and speaking to one of the people who did manage to speak before the police closed that down. Her name is Debbie Hicks. So it's also Pfizer vaccine announcement week, and I'm joined by Kate, Julie and Delia, four Bristol citizens, three in fact, who believe the lockdown measures are both unnecessary and an insult to our intelligence. That's the thinking behind it, they think, and I would say I agree, is based on junk science, propaganda and vested interests in the corridors of power. So welcome all three of you.
Hi.
Hi.
Now, First of all, I'd just like to ask about you, what you make of this announcement this week of this new vaccine, Pfizer vaccine. Do you think that it's going to be, I mean, we're being told by most of the press and many journalists too, this is a wonderful moment. At last, the rescue is coming over the horizon against the lockdown. Julie, what do you think?
I think that it's very suspicious, the timing of this announcement. I don't know how it ties in with the U.S. elections, but it's very fast. They've done it very fast. A vaccine that has been out in, 7 months, 8 months? Wow.
Okay. Delia, what do you make of this announcement this week?
Absolutely terrifying, to be honest, because it's been proven that a coronavirus vaccine can't actually help anyone anyway, and we'll have to carry on having vaccinations maybe twice a year because the virus is going to mutate, so, which is already done anyway, so there's no way anybody's putting anything inside me against my will.
Okay, Kate, what do you make of this announcement for Pfizer? I mean, Pfizer, let's also remind people that there are quite a lot of people, including Bill Gates, who've got a stake, have invested in Pfizer and invested in this whole vaccine program. A lot of people stand to make a lot of money or lose a lot of money.
Yeah, that's my thoughts, really. You know, we have a flu vaccine that's not effective. People are still dying from the flu. And this vaccine hasn't been tried and tested. They don't know what the long-term effects are going to be. So, you know, it just all seems a bit too much too soon. And we know that there's going to be big pharma will benefit financially from this vaccine. There's just lots of questions that aren't being answered by the government and the mainstream media about the vaccine. And anyone who talks out against it or just wants more information is shut down, which I just think there needs to be a balanced view for and against the vaccine, which is not clearly not being, you know, portrayed on the media.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if people... It's interesting, Julie, what you said about the timing, because this has just happened just as it's been announced that Trump has lost the election. He was putting all his, basically, cards on into saying, well, there's going to be a vaccine by the time of the election. There's definitely going to be a vaccine by Christmas. Now he's out of the way, the vaccine's arrived. Trump is seen, isn't he, as a bit of an anti-vaccine person?
I don't know if he's anti-vaccine, but I do know that he doesn't really want to make it compulsory or mandatory. Like the timing is so interesting. Are you trying to tell us that the vaccine was ready that morning, and you were announcing? And I'm sure they knew of its efficacy at least a few days before. But I don't know how it ties in. It's just like, for me, it's too soon to have a vaccine.
Yeah.
Well, what you're suggesting here is that there's some sort of kind of management of events going on.
I don't know.
Delia, is that possible?
It seems a bit strange and sudden that we should all be faced with this vaccine thing, and that if we just follow the rules, we all sit at home, the only thing that's going to save us is a vaccine, whereas a lot of people know that we've got good immune systems. And if we take things like vitamin D in the winter, vitamin C, we go out, we breathe fresh air, which we're not being able to, which we're being forced not to do. We can use our immune systems, which have been really good for thousands of years, to deal with coronaviruses, which have been around since the dawn of man. So, yes.
Also, a lot of people have had it. Boris had it. Yeah. Trump had it.
Yeah.
And they go well. And
they
didn't need vaccine.
No.
So why do we need the vaccine?
Well, what we're told is that you can catch it again and again.
But we do the flu, we do the common cold.
Yeah.
And look, we're still here. We've had loads of flus and loads of colds. Yeah. And
look, I know you're both, all three of you, thinking about going to this protest tomorrow, which is happening in Bristol City Centre. The police have banned it. But what I'm really interested in, and I'll take you one by one here, is what is it that makes you so annoyed about this that you want to go? Even though we're being told by central government, we've been told by the Bristol City Council, don't come to the protest, stay at home and all this sort of thing. It obviously takes something to say, well, actually, I don't agree with that. I don't believe in what the authorities are telling me, and I am prepared to go out to a demonstration that might be closed down by the police. So I start with you, Kate. What is it that makes you think something like that is important enough an issue to do that?
Because we're being lied to, I think. They're not transparent in the media, in the news, about what's going on. The media is being censored on Facebook, Instagram. The BBC just push one narrative, and that is, we're all going to die. This is such a deadly disease. No one's surviving. Or they paint a bad picture. They don't paint a balanced picture. So for me, if you're being censored and information is not allowed to get out there, or anyone who's got a different point of view is being shut down, then for me, the people that are being shut down need to be heard, because there's a reason why they're being shut down. So I feel it's important that we go out and we, you know, it's our human rights to be able to protest, to have a point of view and not be shut down and not be, you know, labelled a nutter or, you know, we're killing people, when all we're trying to do is look at a balanced view in the facts.
Julie, why do you feel so strongly?
First of all, I think it's extremely convenient for the government to ban protests, meeting more than two people meeting at the same time, under the pretext of public health safety, but they know that it's for dissent, it's not for any other reason. We're not meeting for any other reason except to show our dissent.
Lawful dissent,
yes, for what's going on. We need to be heard. We don't think that everybody should be locked down because a few people are sick. Healthy people being isolated, preventing from going to work, preventing from going to school, preventing from meeting with other people, family. I don't think that's right. That's not in the name of health. That is detrimental to health.
Delia, what motivates you to possibly even risk arrest? We don't know what the police are going to do, to go to a demonstration that's been banned. Why take that step? It's easier to stay at home, isn't it?
It's not easier to stay at home because I'm standing up for all future generations and everybody that I know and love and everyone that I don't know and love. We've got to do this for everyone, really. We should all be standing up and saying no to it, because what we're actually dealing with here is tyranny. It's been proven historically that when rights are taken away, they never ever come back. And this is basically criminal coercion, what we're all going through at the moment. The government are using nefarious tactics, inhumane tactics. They're using fear to push all of us into a state of not being able to think properly. And because now I'm not afraid of the virus, I don't even care if I get it, because I might be ill for a couple of days. Okay, so what? It's not going to kill me. I know that, because I've got a healthy immune system, and everybody should feel the same. We've got to just say no to this tyranny. And unfortunately, the police are just following orders. And my dad used to be a policeman for 30 years. I spoke to him at the beginning of this whole thing, and I showed him the Coronavirus Act. And I had seen at that point the police and how they treated people in London just sitting in a park on their own, and the way they were being manhandled and arrested for literally doing nothing wrong. So my dad, bless him, he's in his late 70s now, so I'm not going to tell him what his colleagues are actually up to, because he would be absolutely disgusted. And I said to him, so what happens if I'm arrested for not doing these things here? And he said, well, I can't arrest you, because it's just an act. It's they are guidelines. It's not law. And so basically the police are acting unlawfully by treating normal, healthy people.
It's interesting, when the police put out their announcement yesterday that the protest is being banned and that people must not go to the protest, obviously in Bristol that can sometimes mean, well, hey, there's something we ought to go to if we're being told we mustn't. but as part of that, they said that the demonstration was unlawful. Now, unlawful refers to civil law, not criminal law. The police deal with criminal law, not civil law. So it sounds to me as if the police already think that they may be on shaky ground, and that if anyone does get arrested, I would say tomorrow Make sure that you film everything, keep a record of everything that happens, because you may well be entitled to quite a hefty compensation for unlawful arrest, that sort of thing. So anyway, let's have a listen now to a clip of Professor Alison Pollock, because one of the main issues that it's been starting to kind of emerge from our discussion here is this whole thing of testing, because we've got lots of mass testing going on of people that don't have any symptoms, which many medical professionals say is completely unprofessional to test people with no symptoms, especially using this PCR test. And also, alongside that, we've got testing of mass communities, whole communities, like the whole of Liverpool, for example, being tested. Now, of course, any test that delivers false positives, even if it's only one in 99 false positives, if you're starting to test tens of thousands of people or hundreds of thousands of people, you're going to come up with many, many false positives, which actually may be the figures that we're getting. So there's a potential problem there. Anyway, Professor Alison Pollock for many, many years has been campaigning to save the National Health Service, really alongside many Labour Party campaigners, etc., to say, well, this is a fantastic service for everybody and that we mustn't see it eroded. But she's now at odds with much of what the National Health Service has been doing. And here she is being shut down by the BBC, a very short interview, actually. She didn't really get a chance to talk much about tests. And as you'll hear, the BBC eventually don't let her even finish her sentence. But let's have a listen to Professor Alison Pollock now talking about testing.
The government has spent £12 billion on a centralised, privatised contact tracing system that doesn't work. And now it wants to spend £100 billion mainly on private sector contracts on Operation Moonshot. That's the mass testing programme. It hasn't even got the basics right, but there are really a lot of concerns because mass testing is screening of a healthy, well population. It's a very complicated and complex intervention, and this really should have been trialled with small pilots and where the tests have been carefully evaluated, and we're looking also at the harms as well as any potential benefits. So here is the government rolling out a huge programme without having piloted it to look at harms or benefits or costs.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I note your opposition to private contracts, and your views about private intervention in the NHS are well known. I just wonder, from a scientific point of view, what are your objections to mass testing?
Well, the evidence for the private sector involvement is scientific. It's based on very good analysis, and we have the evidence with the failed test and trace. But I'm going to come back to the issue of the screening. The government has a test, which is putting out tests at the moment, but these tests, the public have been given misinformation. It is not a test which tells you whether you have infection or whether you're infectious. It simply tells you whether you have bits of the RNA virus. Now, in a place like Liverpool, where the rates of infection are falling dramatically, it's very likely that quite a lot of the population will have evidence of old infection. And that, especially in children, could result in them being isolated unnecessarily and harmfully. The second thing about this test is not only is it not a test that tells you whether you have infection or infectiousness, these tests have not been evaluated in community settings. We do not know whether they work and what they tell us in community settings. And the government's just spent £100 million for Liverpool buying something called Innova tests, which explicitly say they should not be used in community settings. The third thing to say is the WHO and SAGE have said focus on identifying people with symptoms and isolating them. It's really important to do that, and they do not recommend mass asymptomatic testing. And that is also because we have not established whether the screening intervention works and what the harms and the benefits are, because it's a very complex programme and we don't know how it's going to integrate into primary care or into public health and how it's actually going to be effective.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thank you. I'm sorry to cut you off there. We're short on time. Thank you so much. That's Professor Alison Pollock.
That's just typical of the mainstream media shutting down anybody that's got a dissenting view. I mean, anybody who's listening to this should go off and do their own research, like we have. because basically from what I understand, the PCR test has become the gold standard, but it can't be used to diagnose anything, only to support a diagnosis. So if you've got a fever, you've got coughing, coughing or shortness of breath, for instance, symptoms, it's only to be used to find a virus genome in only small parts. So even if you've got a positive PCR, it doesn't even mean that you've got the virus or anything. It just basically means that maybe you had a tiny bit of it from months ago.
So, Julie, what Alison's saying there is that actually it's designed to detect bits of old virus as well and amplify them. And also they're amplifying these bits of the old virus more than they're supposed to be doing.
Which means that it's like if you're looking hard enough, you're going to find anything. If you amplify and amplify and amplify, you can find a dust. If you don't see it very clearly with your naked eye, but if you put a magnifying glass, you're going to find a dust, isn't it? So what they're saying is that we amplify until we find something. But even Dominic Raab went on a TV show, in the morning TV show, I think, and he said, the percentage of false positives is 97%. So out of 100 people testing positive, 97 of them will be false positive.
Actually, just to say that he actually said, Dominic Raab and also Boris Johnson both said, just to make it clear, that they both said on TV that the tests are only 7% accurate.
This is a bit weird in a way, isn't it?
Because we're all
93%. Sorry, yeah, if I said 97%.
What I'm saying is we're all having to do our own journalism.
Yeah.
You know, because the mainstream journalists aren't really doing the job. As you just heard, at least they allowed Alison Pollock on to speak there. Mm-hmm. But they did then close her down. I just wonder, do you actually read the news, watch the news? You must get your information from somewhere, Kate.
I kind of dip into the BBC to see what propaganda they're putting out to the masses, but you know, and then I go and listen to other doctors who aren't getting heard and kind of try and get a balanced view. But I don't trust the BBC at all. You can just see what they're doing there. She was going to probably carry on and say stuff that they didn't like, didn't fit the narrative, so they shut her down. And they do that with a lot of people. So, you know, you can't trust the PCR test, then you can't trust the stats, because they're testing or picking up old coronaviruses. So we're basically locking down the country for cases as well, and we don't even know they've got COVID-19.
Yes, the PCR test, it's clear that you don't know if you're infectious. You just have something in there, but doesn't mean you're infectious, doesn't mean you're sick, doesn't mean anything.
Before all of this, if you went to your doctor with no symptoms and asked to be tested
for a virus
or a disease, he would laugh you out of the surgery.
And you'd be called a hypochondriac.
Exactly. So they're turning us all into hypochondriacs. They're trying to separate humanity. They're trying to make us all think that we're all infectious. And it's just hideous what's happening.
Basically, you know, meeting people, and we're becoming afraid of people.
Exactly.
You see it in the shops, don't you?
Imagine what it's doing to young kids.
Yeah, so they're trying to test healthy people instead of actually treating actual sick people.
Okay, so one of the doctors, you were just talking about doctors being censored there, who's been massively censored, who used to be all over the media, actually. He was on the radio, he had columns in newspapers and things. He's a chap called Dr. Vernon Coleman. Mm. And he was on the Richie Allen program on Monday this week, as he is, I believe, every Monday, with just a brilliant, brand new book out all about masks. And he actually took, and I could hardly believe it, 40 minutes to go through all of the different reasons why masks are no good for you. Now, he doesn't do things by halves, old Vernon. And he's somebody who I first came across in the 1990s. I bought a book from an alternative bookshop by him called How to Stop Your Doctor Killing You. Now, he is himself a doctor. And so let's have a listen now to some of the interview, which was immediately censored by YouTube. As soon as Richie Allen put that interview up on YouTube, YouTube took it down. Obviously, what happens is you get a whole bunch of trolls go on there and they make complaints to YouTube immediately saying, Vernon Coleman is saying things which are not part of government guidance. and the government guidance, it must be right, government guidance to do things like take people out of hospitals and put them into care homes must be right. And so let's have a little listen now to Vernon here talking about some of the censorship that's been going on, but also his new book, by the way, is called Proof That Masks Do More Harm Than Good. And here he is talking about being censored.
Before all this, a long time before all this, I actually used to appear on Talk Radio. It used to be Talk Sport, didn't
it? Talk Sport, yeah.
I used to appear on Talk Radio every week. And I frequently spoke to Ian Collins, and I spoke to James Whale. James Whale's on Talk Radio, isn't he? I knew James Whale from when he was on Yorkshire TV and Radio Air in Leeds. And I knew him from Talk Radio. They used to have me on those programs every week. But strangely, curiously, now not so keen. I wonder why that could be.
So there he is talking about how he was doing lots and lots of work in the media. All of a sudden he's frozen out, even from Talk Radio. So what he was saying was that they said, well, you can come onto a panel programme. But he said, well, look, I don't want to just do a panel programme. I don't mind doing a one-to-one interview. Or ideally, I would like to do a live interview with Matt Hancock, or a live interview with Dr. Fauci, or a live interview with Chris Whitty. But I'm not going to come on some panel thing. By the time you get to me, you know, on the panel, you've got a panel that's rigged against me. So, you know, he's a media savvy chap, and he's interested in talking to people, but he's not interested in being filtered out by the mainstream press. So anyway, his book, The Proof That Masks Do More Harm Than Good, that's out this week. I could not believe 40 minutes of pretty much monologue by him. Bits and pieces from his book about various reasons why masks do more harm than good. But here's a quick summary of what he had to say. It's only about 5 minutes long, but here is some of the main points that he makes in his book about masks, because I think masks are the most visible way to see that this is actually going on. Otherwise, for some people, they wouldn't even know it was happening.
The debate's been suppressed. Research material's been actually removed from the internet, and the fact checkers are so busy saying, oh, no, it's perfectly, masks are perfectly safe. They can't do you any harm. They don't affect your oxygen or carbon dioxide levels. You must all wear masks. So I've spent weeks digging out all the facts and looking at what happens, because masks, you have to remember that it's been known for years that mask wearing will break the will of people who wear them and make them subservient. The CIA, mask wearing is one of the CIA torture techniques. And allied to that, we've got this nonsense that was first promoted by the dick woman from the Met Police.
Cressida the Dick, yeah.
But the dick woman who said that we should make people feel ashamed if they don't wear masks. I don't know whether she knew at the time, but what she was doing was saying that the mentally and physically disabled who can't wear masks, she was meaning that they were going to be harassed and abused if they dared to leave their homes. That made me so cross. And now we've got people who are wearing masks outside, even though technically they don't have to. The BBC website rarely publishes a picture of anyone outside who hasn't got a mask on. And it's pretty clear that people are soon going to be forced to wear masks out of doors, even when they're exercising. And I would remind you that two children have died in China and two died in Germany because they were exercising while wearing masks. There's been at least one vehicle accident already because somebody crashed because they were wearing a mask and got hypoxic. And a workman fell off a ladder because he suddenly got dizzy because he was wearing a mask. There was a paper published in the Annals of Royal College of Surgeons of England that found no difference in wound infection rates whether or not the surgeons wore surgical masks, and that's why a lot of surgeons actually don't wear a mask in the operating theatre. And don't forget, surgeons and nurses, of course, who work in an operating theatre are trained never to touch any part of the mask apart from the ear loops and the nose bridge. If you touch a mask elsewhere, and if you stuff it in your pocket, the mask is useless. You should throw it away. What they also don't tell you when they're talking about masks on the BBC is that after 2 hours, you throw it away. So if you wear a mask for 12 hours, travelling to work, at work and going home, you need 6 masks. After 2 hours, a mask is much more dangerous than it is right at the beginning. There was a paper in the British Medical Journal. I don't know whether the BBC recognises that as a accepted journal, but the British Medical Journal published a paper on cloth masks, which concluded that cloth masks should not be recommended for healthcare workers. There was a research by 4 French doctors which showed that if you wore a surgical mask for a 6-minute walking test, they found that the patients had dyspnea, they couldn't breathe properly. There are definitely problems with oxygen and carbon dioxide. The United States Occupational Safety and Health Administration has looked at this. You can get problems because the amount of oxygen in a room, if the amount of oxygen in any airspace falls below 19.5%, it's not safe for workers. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration in America has also done research on carbon dioxide levels, and if you get to a level, acceptable levels are 800 parts per million, and yet the parts per million in room, even in rooms where there's a lot of people, can reach 1200. If it goes above that, much above that, then people aren't allowed to be in that environment, otherwise their employer can be arrested, sued, whatever. The evidence, there are dozens of scientific papers, again, all in the book listed. There are dozens of scientific papers, meta-analyses, Centers for Disease Control in America, who have said that face masks don't work. Dr. Jenny Harris, you'll love this, Deputy Chief Medical Officer in the UK, warned that it's possible to trap the coronavirus in a mask and then start breathing it in. She said wearing a mask was not a good idea. Chris Whitty said in March that wearing a face mask had almost no effect on reducing the risk, and that the government did not advise healthy people to wear masks. Strange how he changed his mind.
Yeah.
Where's the evidence, Mr. Whitty? The evidence, sorry, Professor Whitty, the evidence from the Mask for All organization, evidence from Bill Gates, evidence from the BBC, where's the evidence? There was a meta-analysis in May in 2020 from the Centers for Disease Control, which concluded that randomized control trials didn't support a substantial effect on the transmission of influenza. In other words, it's pointless. The face masks have pores 5,000 times larger than the virus particles. Think about it. It means that the virus can wander through your face mask just like a mouse wandering through Marble Arch.
So the virus can wander through a face mask like a mouse wandering through Marble Arch or a fly flying through a fence. I mean, I think you may be over-egging it there, because apparently the virus does sit in water droplets, which are a bit bigger than just the virus, obviously. But I mean, the amazing thing, I suppose, about that, that's just a summary of 40 minutes of him doing a summary of all the reasons not to wear a mask. And I mean, they're all from official reports and medical journals, which is, you know, the most incredible thing about Vernon Coleman is he gets all these things, and he will go through all what the professionals are saying. He's also pointing out the hypocrisy. And just to remind listeners that that is what YouTube censored this week. They weren't allowing people to hear that. And so I downloaded it off Richie Allen's show directly and retransmitting it. But can I just get your thoughts on masks?
I've never worn one. I never will wear one.
But if masks were so amazing, in hospitals, everybody, every nurse and every doctor would be wearing them, regardless of whether or not they are doing an operation or any procedure or anything.
Yeah.
Hospitals are, they're very known to have all kind of ghastly diseases. And yet, staff in hospitals don't wear it all the time. Well, if it was a good thing, it would have been something.
I can tell you, when I was over in New Zealand, we were stuck in New Zealand when all this started back in March. I was told by a guy who worked in hospital there, he said, well, this has all happened a year or so ago in New Zealand, where they wanted everybody who's in the medical profession and working in hospitals to have the flu jab. Lots and lots of people wouldn't have the flu jab. Something like 80% said, well, I just don't want the flu jab, thank you. And after a few months, they realised that the take-up was very low amongst medical professionals. They didn't, for whatever reason, decide they didn't want to have it. So what happened was they said, you're not allowed to come to work unless you've got a mask on, if you haven't had the flu jab. And very quickly, many of the medical professionals then said, oh, well, I will have the flu jab so I can come to work and I won't lose my job. So that seems to me...
That doesn't sound like coercion at all.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is, isn't it? But so let's also have a listen now. Sorry, just hear your any more thoughts on masks before we move on.
I have got one of those cards. I don't actually wear it, but... I keep it in my bag for when I'm going shopping, and it's fine. When you go shopping, just walk around. I smile at especially young kids because they're so surprised to see somebody with a face. And
well, you know what? The other thing is, if you're not wearing a mask, wink. Everyone else that's not wearing a mask.
I always do.
It's almost like, you know, this is the French Resistance or something in occupied Nazi Germany.
Yeah.
We know all these people don't.
I also want to speak about Nazi Germany, that especially when you go into a bar or a pub or a restaurant where actually I used to work and I was the only person working there without a mask on. The way that the staff would treat customers because they forgot to put a mask on for 2 seconds was absolutely like the brown shirts, the Hitler Youth. They've just been, I don't know why they think it's okay to tell people like to wear a uniform. I mean, it's crazy because the seats themselves were, once they're sitting up on their chairs, they were at standing height anyway, so... It's just crazy that people can think that the
Rona
virus doesn't
goes
affect
high,
you
doesn't,
when you're sitting down.
Rona doesn't stay low, doesn't lay low,
no.
It goes high. So you need to, every time you stand up, you
it's
in
basically
danger.
During the so-called height of the pandemic, we were all wandering around the supermarket, we were touching things. People weren't dropping dead in the street like all the scare tactics from Wuhan on the TV. And then all of a sudden, when in the midsummer, when it's obvious that any flu virus is going to go, we're all being told to wear a mask to keep a visual representation
that
of a thing
still around,
that's not even going to do anything to us. If we weren't wearing masks, no one would even think about it. We'd just get on with our daily lives.
By the way, one of the main things that a mask does to you is it reduces your oxygen.
Exactly.
So if you've got anything like a dizzy spell or headache, just take it off. I can remember being in a shop on the outskirts of Bristol with a lady who was really struggling working in the shop with a mask, an elderly lady, and I said, look, you do realise, love, you don't have to wear it if it's causing you trouble. So she then took it off and thanked me as a customer, you know, which was amazing.
Yeah, I just think, like, you know, going back to Vernon, you know, he's one that's challenging the narrative, and he's used the evidence that they have access to that they were using at the start when we weren't wearing masks. And there's lots of videos out there of Witty, of Boris, that doctor, all loads of doctors, Fauci, all saying masks do not work. Mm-hmm. And they told us that, you know, of the negative effects of wearing masks, which you've just said. And then all of a sudden, that years of studies are just thrown out the window. And then these, you know, the masks do work. And we're supposed to just forget about that. You
are
know,
those signs,
you can't question
sorry
it.
To interrupt, but those signs on the tube when I've gone into London to demonstrate. We're sitting on the tube and the signs that are up there are so 1984. I wear my mask to protect you. You wear yours to protect me. It's like, well, if you want to wear two masks, that's fine, but I'm not going to wear a mask to protect a healthy person.
Well, Vernon Coleman actually does talk about psychological warfare, so let's have a listen to the final clip from the censored by YouTube Richie Allen program earlier this week.
There's tons of info on the website that you can turn into a letter and just write, when you see something in a paper or a magazine that says everybody should be doing this or that or isn't this wonderful or whatever, just send a short letter with a pithy point about some aspect of what they've said in the paper or the magazine and say, but what about such and such? And there's a good chance that they'll print it. And that'll make people think.
And when you make people think and question what's going on, they're more likely to be a little bit more sceptical and start looking for more evidence that they have been lied to. And boy, never in history, never in history have people been lied to as much as people are being lied to now. I don't believe that. I think Goebbels would be really proud, really, really proud of what the PSYOP people are doing at the moment. They're causing mayhem. They're causing distress. They're causing fear. And it's not by accident. It's all on purpose. Every time the government cocks up, it isn't an accident. They're doing it on purpose. The confusion, the bewilderment, are we going to be allowed to have Christmas or not?
Yeah.
Is the closed lockdown on the house arrest in England going to stop in early December? Is Wales going to bring another lockdown in? The confusion is all deliberate. It's part of a PSYOP. One of the first videos I did was on brainwashing and how they're using brainwashing and PSYOP techniques, military PSYOP techniques, which are supposed to be used against an enemy. They're using it against us. The Army's 77th Brigade, we pay for them. We pay their salaries and their wages. And yet they're now attacking us. And they're trying to close down what we say. And you can see the comments. I tell you what, one of the easy ways to spot them when they put comments on videos and stuff is they always try to demonize whoever's written. If a doctor said something, then they'll try to demonize them by saying something rude and irrelevant. That's how they operate. It's part of a vast psychological operation, and I think it is absolutely disgraceful that our government is paying people to attack British people and to suppress the truth so that the lies can flourish.
I love he mentioned of psychological manipulation, because it is a PSYOP. It's a psychological manipulation through and through. You have ads from the government that shows everybody in masks. But not only that, I came across an ad a few months ago about marital allowance or something like that. It came from the government, and it shows a couple in their own home on their own sofa, both wearing a mask.
It's the same with adverts, though. Every time you switch a TV on, it's, you know, they're slowly bringing in, you wear a mask in this situation, wear a mask in that situation.
This is the new normal that they want you to get accustomed to, and that is wear masks everywhere, including in your own home with your husband or, you know, your other half. Or ads coming from Heineken, where it shows everybody socially distancing and making it look that this is the right thing. That's how you do the right thing. You social distance in a bar.
Influencing behavior, basically.
Social distancing. That how do you call this term where two words don't go together?
It doesn't make sense, does it? Because you can be social even though you're 2 meters away. What it really is, it's physical distancing.
It's not social.
No, what they want you to do is to have social online and everything under surveillance.
Yes, everything they're pushing.
So all of our relationships go online. That's what they seem to want.
Absolutely, including intimate stuff.
Yeah.
That now you're encouraged to do online. Virtual reality, I think. It is a tool to enable
more control. Maybe it's time to switch off the internet.
Absolutely. Well, stop with the games and get out and
it's
enjoy.
It's time to switch off the TV.
Kate, Kate, you're a young person. Could you just do that? You know, is that too much?
What was the question?
Switching off the internet, getting rid of your mobile phone.
No,
I've
definitely done that. Obviously, right now, because people aren't socialising as much, so we're using social media to stay in contact. But definitely, I won't pay for iTunes anymore because I don't support Apple. Same with Amazon. So, there's ways that we can kind of take back power, and that is not to sign up to things, is not to give them our money, basically. And, we could live without the internet, whether it's on a weekend. There's things we can do to take our power back. And I think, yeah, we just got to accommodate and change our ways for the better.
Yeah, the psychology of masks is fascinating. And one person that loves to wear his mask when he's out and about and doesn't really need to is the BBC's Andrew Plant. He's on the TV on Points West many nights. He's one of the presenters on there. And he was over in Stroud on Saturday with his cameraman reporting, or not reporting as the case may be, on the demonstration there, even though there were hundreds of people he could have spoken to and asked them why they were there. He didn't speak to any of them, or at least they didn't use that on the bulletin. But before we hear a bit of the bulletin on Sunday night from the BBC, let's have a listen to the speech, which is a couple of minutes long here, a part of the speech anyway, by one of the speakers, Debbie Hicks, who was later arrested.
What we say to people that object to us doing this today is we're fighting for your right to disagree with us. We're fighting for your freedom of speech. Democracy means having the right to disagree. I fight for everybody's right to disagree with me, and I hope they would do the same. I just want to say about what's happened to our guest speaker today, because this makes us very angry and very sad. Piers Corbyn was arrested in London last night. He was held in a cell, a 72-year-old man, for 23 hours with no explanation why.
Boston!
And this morning he had to go to court in Bromley in London, and he is being held as I speak with no explanation in the court. Is this democracy?
No!
Where have our rights gone? Where's our justice? We want to talk about this with you today. And just one final word about why we're doing this here today. And I'm looking round at this crowd, and you're all so different. And we also have children here with their parents, and that's amazing. We're here for our children. We're here for our grandchildren. We're here for each other, for our neighbours, for our grandparents, and the genocide they've been put through by this government.
So that's Debbie Hicks speaking last Saturday in Stroud. I'll put a full copy of that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. That's just an extract from her speech. And I think it's also well worth, because I had a wander around when I was there. I was supposed to be speaking, and Debbie whisked the microphone out of my hand just as I was about to speak and went on a walkabout and then managed to get arrested, so I didn't get a chance to speak. But I did have a chat to some of the people that came, really doing Andrew Plant's job for him, I suppose, and asked them about why they were there. I mean, particularly there was an elderly lady who said she'd never been on a demonstration before, as you're about to hear, and in her life, and talked about the whole situation with what she was having to go through as being worse than during the Second World War. And then I spoke to a woman just as she was leaving the demonstration, the police closed down, who was a German woman, and with her English husband, who was comparing it to the sort of things that she had heard about from her parents during World War II in Germany, and also from East Germany as well, because they had to visit relatives over in East Germany. So let's have a little listen now to what some of the people were saying actually at Stratford Park itself in Stroud last Saturday to me.
Well, isn't it funny to be living in a country where this sort of thing happens?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it wasn't as bad as this in the wartime, let alone.
You remember that, do you?
I do, well, yes, yeah. I was there. I was only young, mind, but
and there
I've
was,
never been
there
on
was
a demonstration before, so I don't
haven't
know.
You?
No, never, in all my life.
Absolutely fed up with the lies this government is telling, and the fact that this is becoming a Nazi state, and the government is destroying this country, and it's destroying businesses, and it is bringing the country to its knees for Agenda 21, 22, 21, 30, and for the World Economic Forum. And these people cannot see what's happening. It's going to affect them as well.
You're protesting in the middle of a lockdown. You shouldn't be doing that.
No, it's illegal. The whole lockdown's illegal. The figures were absolutely... they weren't true. And they've admitted the figures weren't true. They talked about 4,000 deaths, never in this life. They're using a communist behavioural therapist to actually control everybody.
Who's that?
Susan Nietzsche. Communist, card-carrying member.
Where do you think this is all heading?
I think it's going to head for the government being arrested. And I hope Boris Johnson is arrested for treason, and anybody else, Chris Whitty, the lot, should be arrested for treason.
I've actually put a letter in the Star News and Journal about that. The Nazi regime started very benign. The communist system in Germany, the same. And then, you know, hostile environment. Yeah, was one. Slogans everywhere. Fear. And then you have the people, and then you can do the next thing and the next thing. That's why I think this is the beginning. The imposition on our freedom. On our civil rights.
But they will say, won't they, that they're actually trying to protect us from what is a potentially deadly virus.
Yes, well, is that really so? Is that really a deadly virus in the sense that it is any worse than other epidemics that we have had? That's a big question. The WHO has declared before the first lockdown that this is not a pandemic. Yeah, I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but we have plenty of viruses about, don't we, all the time.
Okay, so where's all this heading, do you think?
Good question. And my feeling is that it is heading towards a dictatorship, tyranny of a medical kind that we've not had before in the world, a medical dictatorship. You see, that you're not allowed to do certain things because you are a danger to others, a perceived danger to others, because you might carry a virus.
Much of the mainstream press is just telling us all the time, you must obey the government is right.
Well, you would be able to answer that more because you have researched that. I mean, the World Economic, what is it called?
World Economic Forum. They've got a lot of material out there.
On the website, yeah. On their website.
And the Rockefeller Foundation Sustainable Development Plan actually describes in quite some detail about what their hope and plan is. So it's a little bit more than just a theory. Maybe it's a conspiracy, but it's more than a theory.
Okay. So what are they planning, in a nutshell?
To have control and full surveillance over the population of the world. And to introduce what they call the fourth industrial revolution, which involves the Internet of Things. It involves a lot more artificial intelligence, and then such things as developing the smart city, and therefore also rewilding of the countryside. So it's quite a fundamental change, so that everybody will be nicely in their places and obedient.
We're basically in the countryside in Stroud.
That's right. That's right. I mean, that's certainly the case. There's quite a movement for rewilding, which on one level is perfectly fine and it's very necessary to have natural habitats. But when it comes to exclude human beings in it, that is then something else. We need to have a farming system, for instance, that really includes nature and you work with nature. Because if you have half of the countryside rewilded, that means that a certain amount is going to be very intensively farmed to feed the population. And that's what we need to get away from. We need to integrate human beings in the landscape with sort of organically without using all these toxins which are destroying wildlife and destroying nature, so that we can then have healthy food being produced in harmony with nature.
Well, that sounds like a much better world. What's the chance of that happening, do you think?
Well, I have to somewhere believe that we will get that the good will prevail. Otherwise, I would give up now, you know. But basically, I think the issue is our freedom. And by freedom, I don't mean just doing what I want to do, but really living in harmony with other human beings and with nature. And to have freedom of movement, freedom of speech, freedom of interaction with whoever I want to interact, without fear.
What do you think about what you've seen here today, though?
Well, I was encouraged that a little town like Stroud had such a good turnout. I was encouraged about that. I was very taken aback by what happened later on, that people were arrested for something that I couldn't see why, for speaking up, for, you know, speaking what is important to them.
And that has triggered something in me in terms of what I know from Germany. You know, I mean, obviously I wasn't around in the Nazi time, but that was my parents' generation. But I witnessed the GDR system, the communist system, as a visitor, because all our relatives lived in the GDR. And as a child, we visited them every summer holidays.
That's East Germany, old East Germany, before the wall came down.
That's right, yeah. And I remember my grandmother coming into the garden and saying, be careful what you say, the neighbors might overhear this. You know, that kind of thing. I remember the soldiers with machine guns when we crossed the border. We were searched for 4 hours often in the heat. And this is what I remember. And so, you know, something like this that's happening, of course, brings back those memories as well. You know, the pain it caused in our family, that most of our family lived in the GDR and we couldn't be with them and they were not allowed to visit us.
We've got a similar thing going on in our care homes, haven't we, with elderly relatives?
Absolutely. And to me, that's criminal. You know, I have a friend whose husband has Parkinson's, is in a care home. She's been able to see him twice, not allowed to touch him, not allowed to be with him on her own. We are talking about a married couple. There's always a member of staff present. She has to be wrapped in plastic and sanitized, but even then she's not allowed to touch him. What is that? What is that? Is that human? You know, I know them both personally since many years, and they are a very loving, close couple who cannot be together now.
Okay, so that's my little vox pop from Stroud last Saturday from the protest, the vox pop that the BBC didn't seem to want to do. What about this whole business of care homes? Because she finishes talking about that, Delia. You know, this is something which is very strange. We've never had this sort of thing before, where you're not allowed, for example, to touch your loved ones.
Well, on one of the...
Or even to see them, actually.
Yes, on one of the protests that I went to in London, I ended up chatting to an end-of-life nurse who'd actually left her job because of the horrific things that she'd seen in the care home. And she told me that during the height, in inverted commas, of the pandemic, because doctors weren't allowed to go into the care homes or they didn't go in, there was unqualified people giving reasons for death on the death certificates, and COVID-19 was put down. When there was no evidence, there wasn't even a test in those days as well. And also later on, she was saying there was things she couldn't talk about because she was too emotional, obviously. But she was saying later on, when the test was available, she was taking the test on Monday, but there was no results till Wednesday. But during that time, she was still allowed to work and mix with the people in the care home. And she was saying that it was inhumane that the families weren't allowed to come and see their relatives. And if they were, they had to wear masks and stand behind a plastic screen. And she just found it too distressing to see these poor people who were suffering dementia anyway, confused, not being able to see their families. And she just had to leave because it was too heartbreaking for her. So what's happening at the moment, what has been happening, is it's basically genocide, getting rid of old people. It's inhumane and it is absolutely disgusting.
You're killing people not just by not giving them medical care, but by depriving them of seeing
human contact,
but particularly depriving them of seeing their loved ones during very difficult times for many, many months.
They deteriorate very fast. So, for example, elderly people and people with dementia, actually seeing somebody from their family can be the only thing that's keeping them going at all.
And this is intentional. I believe this is intentional because the thinking heads who come up with the diabolical impositions on us and restrictions know that human contact is probably the most important thing for us.
Can I just say, the reason why, right at the very beginning of this, I started to look into things was because I had actually a panic attack at the beginning. I didn't realise that's what it was at the time because I've never really had one before. But what happened to me was, because when I thought the virus was real, obviously my life was scary, but I had this panic attack. And what happened to me was that my legs started to go weak. I had shortness of breath. I went very pale. I started to feel sick. And luckily this only lasted a few minutes because I just went to bed. I actually thought that I had the virus. But now when I look back on that, and the reason why I started to look into it was because I was thinking, hang on a minute, that was brought on by fear. So how do I know that somebody who's a lot older than me, who just basically is lonely, sits in front of the TV the whole time, isn't, those symptoms aren't brought on by fear? And I can recover from that because I'm young, I'm well-ish, I'm healthy, but I look after myself, I do exercise, but obviously older people can't do this kind of thing. So how do we know that people aren't actually dying of fear?
Well, those are the sorts of questions that were going around the crowd, the 250 or so people in Stratford Park before the police turned up to close the demonstration down. They weren't certainly doing any social distancing, although the crowd was socially distanced. And so let's have a listen now to the Saturday evening's Points West report by Andrew Plant. And I was really looking forward to seeing him sticking a camera in a few people's faces to see why they were there, but I'm afraid he didn't do any of that.
Police made a number of arrests at an anti-lockdown rally in Stroud today. More than 100 people gathered in Stratford Park to express their opinions on England's coronavirus restrictions. Gathering in large groups became illegal on Thursday under new health protection laws. Gloucestershire Police say they tried to get organisers to cancel the event.
We tried prior to the event starting. We've engaged with the organiser, we've contacted them on Facebook, email to discuss and make them aware to say that the protest shouldn't be happening. So we've tried to be as fair as we can and make them aware of the change in law. Where they insist on carrying on, obviously our role is to protect people's health and enforce the law.
Health protection law, that's why they closed it down. Although, actually, I would have thought that...
Health protection.
Yeah, the police were probably... they were, for example, arresting Debbie, they're touching her. They were actually forcing people not to social distance.
Yeah, we've been to a few protests in the start of, the first lockdown. And obviously, masks weren't mandatory then. And none of the police wore masks. None of them social distance. We've taken pictures of them like congregating in the vans outside, and someone did a Freedom of Information Act, and not one policeman has died. Even now,
in the Met, it's actually one now.
There was only one,
but we don't know how many McDonald's he has had.
Exactly, and we can't trust the PCR test, as we've discovered.
Yeah, exactly.
But if it was a deadly virus, then more people would be getting sick because none of them have social distance or wore PPE. So and no one at the
You don't get many 80-year-old or 90-year-old policemen either.
No.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but then the age range of people that are at risk are the elderly in care homes. So you shouldn't. That then goes back to why should we lock down healthy people? Yeah.
The amazing thing I found was Stroud was that there were lots of the people who come were probably in that elderly range, 70, 80, 80 years old. One of the nice things was once the police had arrested various people, there was still quite a lot of people that wanted to do things. I did my little rant, which was only about 2 minutes long. But just before I did, these three lads from Oxford did a little song. They started basically paraphrasing Winston Churchill's speech, "We will fight them on the beaches." And so let's have a listen now to Lennon, Archie and Oliver from Oxford.
We will beat them in our class! We will beat them in our schools by taking off the mask!
Yeah!
Truth is out. We will win this by the fire!
Yeah!
also saying we will win this by a mile. I mean, there's quite a lot of people out there. You were talking about fear just saying, Delia. I mean, how do we know we're going to win this? Are we going to win this? Or is the fear going to take hold?
I'm definitely remaining positive that we are going to win this.
Why? Because is that just fingers crossed? Or
no.
Julie, go on, Julie.
Because the human spirit just loves freedom. Doesn't matter what
human contact.
What the conditions are, what the threat is. We love freedom.
I was actually speaking to a policeman, really lovely guy, at one of the protests in Bristol a few months ago, and had a lovely long chat with him. And I said to him, so if you have to take a vaccine to be able to go to work, say travel, go out for a meal, how would you deal with that? And he said, well, if that's the case, I will be protesting with you. So I'm hoping that finally people will start to realise that they don't want this vaccine.
Ticketmaster came yesterday saying that they are working in some partnership or whatever to make a condition that to buy tickets and attend a gig would be that you have a vaccine certificate,
yeah,
or something like that. Ticketmaster, so a lot of people buy their tickets to go to gigs from them. And it shows just how they all work together. They all come together to force us to take
Yeah, going back to, you know, are we going to get out of this? I think as time goes on and more of this agenda is exposed, humanity will raise their consciousness and they'll know that the government's lying. I mean, masses of people are waking up, thousands all across the world. So we will not stand for our freedoms being taken away, being forced vaccinated, not to go into a shop. That will wake people up. It just takes different things to wake people up at different times.
I think a lot
times.
Of people know in their heart that something is wrong.
Yes. You just need the power to stand up.
Yeah,
the
fact that
you
need
to
be brave.
Yeah.
You're being threatened of being excluded from society if you do not take the vaccine or the test or whatever. So people are going to see that that's not right. That's not right.
Well, we're going to hear again from Debbie in a minute. But one thing I'd say is I've never seen a protest movement which has had so many women involved. I just wonder why you think that is. I just, you know,
for example,
at Stratford Park in Stroud, I would say it was probably 2/3 women. Quite a lot of women also. Why is it? Is it just me? Am I noticing more women than men?
I'm going to say from a man's point of view, because I've asked men this, and they just said that men have been demasculinated, and that perceptions of, you know, how a man should behave has changed, and women are stronger
due to social engineering.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
But also maybe because the children now have to stay home. And they have to homeschool them, or they cannot go to work because they have young children at home.
Yeah.
So probably that's why more women are.
We've been taught, men especially, to not act on anger. But I actually think the anger that I was feeling at the beginning of this was so strong, it actually made me stand up and not care about what people think about me, because I've been talked about at work. I've had friends who are trying to cut me out of their life because they don't agree with what I'm saying.
Family.
And it's really simple. My whole family is turning against me. My sister seems to think I'm in some cult and that I've been brainwashed. Meanwhile, she's the one watching the news and the BBC and having all these things fed into her brain. And she's the one in the cult, I have to say. But I will be there for her when she comes to me and says, what am I going to do? I'll be like, right, well, you know, it's easy. You just say no.
Yeah. I just want to sort of mention or say, you know, people who are researching and looking at both sides are being condemned for their point of view and going to protest and, you know, you're spreading the virus and you're doing this and you don't care. No, just because we are researching this, spending our time looking into it, that we shouldn't be condemned, because we're fighting for your rights and our rights, everyone's rights. So we should be celebrated, you know, and people should just stand up and start looking into things rather than just following the media.
Yeah, I mean, there it's also maybe a mother's instinct because, you know...
I'm not a mum, though. I know, but
women are surely born with that. They're looking more ahead at the future generations, maybe, than the men
it's
are.
It's true.
Yeah, maybe.
My mothering instinct has obviously kicked in, but I'm glad for the very first time in my whole life that I don't actually have children because this world... is a crazy place.
I do have children and I'm absolutely terrified of what the future holds for them and their children.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to fight this.
But I believe that every child in the world belongs to us all anyway. So
it takes a village.
So let's have a listen to what Debbie had to say. I spoke to her yesterday. This is Debbie Hicks, who was one of the speakers over in Stroud. And there's a full version of this interview up on our show page, or will be later tonight at thisweek.org.uk.
I'm a very spiritual person, and I completely agree with you. I feel it's attack on our spirituality. What is spirituality? It's what makes us human, in my opinion. It's what connects us all to the world, to other people, to the greater sense of everything around us. That's, to me, what it's about, being spiritual. And when you think about it, just logically, if we're all going to be stuck behind computers, we can't go out of our houses, we can't go and see our families, but, you know, there's no social aspect to our life, then that alone is a tap on our spirituality, because that's what makes us, to me, that's what spirituality is about, as well as those connections in the community and with other people. But as you said, you know, that attack on churches in particular is horrifying to me. And, you know, there is echoes there, you know, I mean, in terms of how you want to label this tyranny, there is echoes of the Soviet Union, I feel, as well, in the sense of this, you can't worship, you know, you can't have a religion. And I think that suggests that there's this fear that if people connect too much to their spirituality, that they might fight back and they might recognise this for what it is, this evil, this... Because it is evil. It's beyond ideology, actually. This is just pure evil to feel that you can lock up the elderly, that you can lock up children and put masks on them when there's no evidence that masks are needed, when you can, you know, separate families in this.
You spoke at a demonstration in Stroud on Saturday. Although you gave quite a nice speech, which everyone heard in the park in Stroud, you were then subsequently arrested. So can you just take us through what happened?
Yes. So as you said, I did a speech. I introduced other speakers, and then I went off and I was giving out some legal advice information to people in the park. And then about 40 minutes later, I tried to lead people round to the other side of the park because it looked to me as though the police were going to cattle. So I started to move people to a bigger space because I was worried that they were going to be cattled in. And then I led them round past the tennis courts in Stratford Park. I turned my back for one moment and then my hands were grabbed aggressively. I was handcuffed and arrested. And then I was taken to the police station, held for 6 hours in quite an appalling way, actually. And that will be something that will be followed up. And I was charged with breaching the Corona Act for attending a rally and being involved in a rally. So I'm currently on bail, and I'm on bail until February the 22nd. So I'm in the process this week of getting together a solicitor that's going to represent me. So that's my focus at the moment.
So that's Debbie Hicks, one of the speakers in Stroud on Saturday, who was subsequently arrested, really talking about the spiritual side of this and churches being closed and that sort of thing. What about that? I mean, because that's what we're in a funny situation at the moment, aren't we, where actually religion is kind of out of fashion, and it has been for the last sort of 30-40 years. Churches are getting more and more empty. Even if they were to be open for services, you'd easily be able to socially distance, sometimes with only 5 people in one church.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to make much sense.
I don't know. I'm not religious as such, but I do support people following their faith and being able to go to church or whatever place of worship, and they should be able to continue to do that, not the government deciding you cannot do that because it's not essential.
But supermarkets are okay, though.
Yeah.
I mean, Debbie's characterising it, Delia, as something which is good versus evil there. Mm-hmm. And she really does see it in those terms. This is more about, you know, basically right and wrong, good and evil. And actually what's happening is the legislation is coming down on the side of evil, which is a bit...
Why? Well, it's actually satanic.
I agree.
Why do you say that? Well, you say you're not religious, but it's satanic. That's an interesting
It doesn't matter what I believe.
You can still
it
see it.
It doesn't matter what I believe. It matters that...
What they believe.
The perpetrators of this believe...
They believe in Satan.
Yes, they believe in whatever they believe
because
in.
Because what they're doing to humanity is actually inhumane.
Yes, absolutely inhumane.
It's draconian and it's...
Demonic.
Basically evil.
Diabolical.
Yeah. It's funny how we were told on Guy Fawkes Night, after dark, by Boris Johnson that we're going down a second lockdown route.
That was Halloween.
It was the date. But
on
the date,
a Saturday.
Yeah, on a Saturday.
I didn't know they were on a Saturday.
Thanks for correcting me. But what I mean is we were going, then we went into lockdown on the 5th. Yes.
Isn't a lockdown something that happens in a prison?
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, absolutely. When you are in
isolation.
It's very interesting. Their choice of words, lockdown. It's for prison.
Yeah, it's basically torture.
We are in prison.
anyway, let's have a listen now to Zach Cox. He's the secretary of the World Doctors Alliance, and he's a dentist. He's a dentist from Glastonbury. Although he practices up in Gloucestershire, although I don't know if he's still practicing. But anyway, his life has been rather taken up by this, doing speeches all around Europe. I don't know about other parts of the world. But I spoke to him yesterday or earlier this week, and this is what he had to say about this whole idea of asymptomatic transmission and testing. So the idea that if you've got no symptoms, you're still getting tested.
Even Fauci himself has said that asymptomatic people don't drive pandemics in the entire history of respiratory diseases. They've never been the drivers of pandemics. So, asymptomatic spread is something that we were told to be scared of, but the WHO themselves, Maria van Kerkhove, who's head of the emerging diseases at WHO, said that it was very rare, you know, and they've been following people very closely and in unpublished studies, they've been following people very closely, and she said it was very rare. So asymptomatic spread essentially doesn't affect a pandemic, may not even be a thing at all. I mean, the PCR test, for example, if you test positive but have no symptoms, does that mean that you're infectious or infected? Well, the answer to that is no. The PCR test itself is so flawed. It throws up many, many false positives. Mike Eden said around about 90% false positives. Other people have said 50%. But from the ONS data, when they looked back at the people who are asymptomatic but testing positive, it was around about 86% had no symptoms. It's so flawed. The cases are not cases. Back in the day, a case was somebody who was severely sick, but not somebody who had just tested positive on a PCR test. Why are they flawed? Well, first of all, the inventor, Carrie Mullis, it's been said so many times now. Carrie Mullis, the inventor, won a Nobel Prize for it, for inventing the machine. And he said they're not for detecting infections. So that's strike one. Strike two.
But what are they for then?
Oh, they use them in laboratories to build DNA in a laboratory, in a lab. So they're used in a laboratory as a tool for constructing DNA, not for detecting viruses. Strike two is that if you go over 35 cycles, because they run cycles on these machines to amplify the amount of viruses there. Anything over 35 cycles is commonly accepted as being a false positive. The NHS currently runs 45 cycles on every test. So the tests are very dubious. And then thirdly, they can't test the accuracy of the PCR test.
so they can't test the accuracy of the tests. Oh dear, that's a bit of a problem.
So what's the vaccine for then?
Making money, perhaps. Yeah. I mean, I think the other thing to mention about this vaccine is it's not an ordinary vaccine. These sorts of vaccines have been being developed for the last 15 years or so, and the vaccine firms have got lots of funding from hedge funds and that sort of thing to develop the vaccines.
Okay. Oh, so it's not a recent thing. It's not a due to this crisis.
These sorts of things like the CRISPR vaccine, gene-altering vaccines, it's just that they haven't never before managed to get them approved. The health regulators say, well, this just is not safe. You know, you put it into someone, it's going to snip their genes and chop their DNA.
Take the vaccine at your own peril.
But this has presented them with quite a nice opportunity to get those through. Anyway, let's also have a listen. He has Zach, his own analysis of what's really been going on with the virus spreading back in March and April and what's been happening since, and why he believes that the government have engineered a second lockdown.
It's a lockdown. I mean, the most obvious comparison we can make is with Sweden and our lockdown and end of lockdown, or end of the peak of the lockdown, coincided virtually within days of Sweden. So, and they didn't lock down. So their pandemic ended within 48 hours of ours, presumably because of herd immunity, because they haven't got a vaccine or anything exciting like that. And seeing as ours ended within 48 hours of theirs, I would suggest that we therefore have herd immunity too, despite locking down. Carl Hennigan said we locked down on after the peak of the infection. So the peak of the infection, he said, was the 18th of March. We locked down on the 23rd. And as you know, the disease was downgraded from a disease of high consequence on the 19th of March by the UK government. So, and the reason for that was because they said there was a low mortality overall. So it was no longer a disease of high consequence. So why did we lock down is the question everyone should be asking. And secondly, if you don't lock down like Sweden didn't, why did their pandemic end at the same time as ours? If theirs ended presumably because of herd immunity, ours ended at the same time, presumably we have herd immunity. So this long tail that it's got, where June, July, August, September, nobody was dying virtually. I mean, there were one or two deaths and COVID wards were by and large empty. That's 4 straight months where nothing was happening.
Yeah, but hang on, because the death rate, surely during that time, Zach, the death rate is creeping up, actually.
Well, June, July, August and September, they weren't completely flat. COVID admissions completely flat. Deaths completely flat. That means that the pandemic is essentially over at that point when you have 4 clear months of nothing happening. I don't think anyone can dispute that. And I think what we see now is a new season. It's a new seasonal flu.
So that's interesting. Zach is saying that what may be going on now is a new seasonal flu. But he's also particularly worried about this whole idea of having endless lockdowns, not just one in March and one in November, this going on and on and on, almost like the kind of never-ending war on the virus, rather like the never-ending war on terror.
Tony Fauci said we're going to go on till at least the end of 2022 with these crazy lockdown measures. I dread that. I really dread that. And I think the people of England and the world need to wake up and realise what's happening. This is no longer, I believe, about a virus. This is about changing our government and the structure of government. And, even their government's own advisors, Professor Mark Woolhouse from Edinburgh University, who's a professor of infectious diseases and epidemiology, and he's a member of the SPIBE, the Scientific Pandemic Influenza Group. He said, he was in the Express, and he said lockdown was a panic measure, and I believe history will say trying to control COVID-19 through lockdown was a monumental mistake on a global scale. The cure is worse than the disease. So, you know, their own advisors are saying don't do lockdowns. I think was it Dr. Navarro from the WHO who said lockdowns no longer recommended anymore by the WHO. So why are we doing another lockdown?
Well, I had to edit out a little swear word he put in at the end there.
I find it very interesting that he said about the perpetual kind of lockdowns. And coronavirus seems ideal if you want to oppress people permanently or indefinitely. They tried in a water terror, they tried swine flu, bird flu, but these were coming from like birds, they're coming from swine. Coronavirus is brilliant because it's all around all the time. And this can be a perfect opportunity for any oppressive thinking heads to use it to keep us perpetually in some sort of lockdown and fear.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, but gold, they struck gold here.
Finally, from Zach Cox, here he is talking about what he believes are our God-given rights being stripped.
I'm not a lawyer, but it seems to me, and I guess to you, I know it's going to be for you too, Tony, that we're born on this planet Earth, and that gives us fundamental rights. The government don't give us rights. These rights are given to us by God, and the governments should be protecting these rights. You know, free speech, freedom to assemble, freedom to peacefully protest. There are rights. Absolutely, there are rights. And I don't believe that this legislation that's been passed recently can trump our human rights, our God-given rights, our inalienable rights. So I believe that it's right that we should be allowed to protest. It's right that we should be able to debate these things in a peaceful way. You know, I don't believe the police should be breaking up protests like this. Lord Sumption pointed out quite clearly that the protests run by Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion were not heavily policed, where they were allowed to get on and protest freely how they wanted to. Whereas the protests against the lockdown, with speakers who were doctors and dentists and nurses and psychiatrists and lawyers and surgeons and eminent scientists, they were broken up by riot police wielding batons, and police horses were used as well. And the police brutality was extreme. And in my view, totally unnecessary, totally unlawful. And when I experienced it firsthand, I felt that perhaps I'd stepped off the train, not in London, but perhaps in communist China.
Well, I think it's interesting that he uses that analogy, because actually in communist China, they have this new health app that everyone has to use there. And this is the result of the coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan. And it basically tells you whether you're allowed to go out of the house or not. So only if it turns green are you allowed to go out of the house. If it's amber or red, you're not. If you're amber, you have to stay isolated for 7 days. And if it's red, you have to stay isolated for 14 days. So they're not really giving you any explanation and
or
proof.
Any chance
but they're just saying you're red, you've got to stay indoors for 2 weeks, you're amber. So, you know, you've got, that's why I think he's saying it's a bit like communist China, not just because the police are coming down and closing down the right to protest, but also because we're moving towards this whole idea of some kind of surveillance control whereby
social credit system.
Yeah, well, that's what they have over there. Anyway, yeah. let's try and look towards solutions to all of this, because obviously one of the solutions tomorrow is to demonstrate and to go out and talk about these things, to hear stuff that's been censored by the mass media. The police are going to try and close that down, but I imagine that Bristolians, being what they were, are, will be out there anyway. What are your thoughts, first of all, Kate, then, on solutions?
Well, all through this, you feel kind of powerless, and you're kind of like, well, how are we going to get out of this? So my way of kind of feeling empowered was to learn about common law. Common law is the law of the land, which a lot of people don't know about. We are living, breathing men and women, and we have rights to consent or not consent. So you have a right to hold your details. You do not have to contract with the police unless you cause harm or loss. So the other thing that people need to understand is that a trespass is made over people at birth. So you have a birth certificate and then you're registered with the state. You then become a corporate entity, a person, which is a corporation, so that the government, who are a corporation can contract with you. Everything in life is contract.
Well, say, what about say a gypsy or a traveller that hasn't registered their birth, but they're there anyway?
Well, yeah, because they live under probably common law and they know their rights. They know that common law, you do not have to contract. You have the right to consent or not consent.
Okay, so if anyone's interested in that, have you got some sort of place online or some search terms that you might not wish to use Google, maybe? Well, a different search engine that people can have a look at this a bit more?
There's the common law courts. You can look at them on the website. They've got their own website. You can also, there's a lot of Facebook groups. So obviously you just start chatting to people. I can't give out the Facebook group now, but there's a few. There's also people that stand under the Magna Carta. There are a lot of people waking up to this trespass at birth and understanding who they are and not living in fear anymore. We do not have to consent to tyranny.
The police are still going to come and arrest you when they feel like it, aren't they?
They will, but you have to stand your ground and not consent, create joinder with the police, because once they got your name, the fictional name, then job done. You basically do not consent.
Can I just say that one protest, me and my friend were nearly arrested, but we stood our ground. We used common law language and we basically answered every single question that they gave me with a question, because the person who is asking the question is king. It's very interesting and important, the language that you use. Yeah. When they are saying to you, do you understand? You say, I do not understand, because what you're saying then is you're creating a contract by standing under them.
Also, under their authority.
Also, the final thing that I would say is that the thing that stopped me from being arrested was that I warned the police officer with my phone, recording them, and I had their name and number. And I said to them, I'm warning you, if you arrest me, I will hold you personally accountable. So that's without the help of the police behind them.
Is also that there are plenty of solicitors out there, and I wonder whether they're going to start making a little bit more money at the moment with the police actions the way they are, do take actions against the police. I've done it myself.
You don't stand under their jurisdiction. No. You stand under the common law jurisdiction.
But you can still take actions against the police for wrongful arrest.
If
you do get arrested.
There is so much to learn about common law. Yeah, it's mind-boggling.
It's actually very simple as well, though.
It sounds to me, I'm afraid, it sounds like mind-boggling stuff that isn't necessarily going to stop you getting arrested, but it might be helpful if you feel you've been wrongfully arrested and you want to then take a prosecution against the police.
I disagree with that. I think it's the very simple thing to understand is that even under their jurisdiction, which is legality, that you do not have to give your name. No. You're not committing a crime. You have the rights to withdraw any information. There's no obligation to give them your name, even under their jurisdiction.
One thing I would tell you from Stratford Park on last Saturday, when the police first came over to Debbie and said, well, we want your name, she just refused to give it, etc. So then they went away, they said, we're going to arrest you if you don't give us your name. She said, I'm refused to give you my name. And then the police said, oh, okay, well, we better go away and consult. So they do seem to be a bit iffy and shaky on the law, particularly with these not being a normal statute law, but being guidelines that they seem to be following at the moment. And the fact that tomorrow's demonstration, which I have to plug again, I suppose, here at College Green in Bristol, the police were saying that they believed it was an unlawful demonstration, not an illegal demonstration.
I think the terminology is getting mixed up, and I don't think the police really understand common law to its entirety.
This is kind of new territory we're in here. It's bizarre. Anyway, Julie, what do you think on terms of solutions? So something a bit of light at the end of the tunnel, I suppose. We all need that, don't we?
I think that it's very important for people to get kind of both sides of the, or not both sides, but different perspectives of what's going on, rather than just listen to one that comes from the media. The media, as we can see, is full of fear, full of propagating fear all day long. And there is a lot of dissenting voices that I think people should also listen to be able to make informed decisions about what's going on and what's good for them and for their children.
So what we're saying really is that you can't trust the news anymore. You're going to have to go, and people don't necessarily have the time. People don't have to necessarily have the time to go and chase up all these facts to find out what's true and what isn't. They have to rely on the media, don't they?
No. I fully believe that people should go out and research for themselves Agenda 2030. The words sustainable development actually sound really lovely, but they're actually terrifying.
Isn't this just going to make us more depressed?
No.
Well,
knowledge is power. And also, if I can just advise people to maybe watch this beautiful film called The Lives of Others, which is what it's like living in, what it was like living in East Berlin, because this is what we are heading to if people don't stand up. I mean, basically, if you don't think that what's happening is right, then just say no. It's really easy. Go and see your friends, have people over, open your shop, go to the supermarket without a mask on. Just say
just
no.
Say no.
It's really easy. Just do that.
Personally, I'm more concerned about losing my freedoms rather than catching the virus.
Exactly.
And even getting arrested.
I'm willing to die for this.
Really?
Yep.
Well, yes.
Look at Aaron, a holy skin. He knows his rights. Watch his videos. He knows common law. That it was an unlawful arrest today at the shop. This will get thrown out.
Say, so this is a bit of news from today, maybe being reported as we speak on local news, etc. So this is an arrest of a tattooist called Aaron. Whereabouts is his tattoo place?
It's in Gloucester Road. Gloucester Road, just across the road from Sainsbury's.
And why was he arrested, do you know?
Because he stayed open during the lockdown, and he knows his rights. He knows his rights under common law, and he exercised them perfectly well. Great example if you watch his videos. It was an unlawful lockdown. The police will be held accountable, so will the council, and it will be taken to a lawful court.
What was he doing? What I'm saying is, was he doing social distancing stuff inside his tattoo parlor or not? That's kind of crucial, isn't it?
He's a tattooist, so obviously he's going to touch the person.
He knows
that
there
is
are any
tattooing.
Guidelines. It's not law.
Well, what I'm saying is, for example, we've had the whole hospitality industry closed down for another 3 weeks, I think it is, isn't it? Nearly 3 weeks. And that many of them are saying, well, actually, we've put all these measures in place.
We've spent all this money
and done all this, and now you've said we've got to close. So it almost seems like an attack on their ability to make
it.
Of course it is.
And dentists are allowed to work. They wear masks and PPE, which is what they've been told to use. So why is having a tattoo any different?
Well, maybe it isn't.
I'd like to know why is he not allowed to earn a living for himself and his family, but say the police that harass him or the council people that harass him are allowed to stay employed and provide for their families. What's the difference? Why the discrimination? I'm very interested to know
that. Well, that's a good question. It would probably come out in court, and it's great. It'd be an interesting test case to see how Aaron gets on. My final point is actually about something called chloroquine, which we haven't mentioned yet, because Pepe Escobar back in March wrote a fascinating article all about how the French government had requisitioned all the supplies of chloroquine in France. I mean, I think this is really the smoking gun of this whole affair. But back in 2005, SARS, when that was spreading, there were a lot of tests done on it, and they found that chloroquine is a very, very cheap drug that's been around for something like 70 years, maybe 60 years, and it's used for treating malaria. But they found that as soon as people got SARS, if they got SARS within a couple of days of catching it, and they took one of these pills of chloroquine, it would actually stop the SARS multiplying inside their body. And yet the French government, in the middle of January, requisitioned all the supplies of chloroquine in France and also took it off the list of things that people could buy over the counter and reclassified it as a poison. Now, I was in court. I won't tell you, we were talking about that in a little while, about the Traveller's Injunction case hearings that's going on right under the nose of Thangam Debonair, who's the Labour housing spokesperson on Minor Road, the Bristol City Council trying to injunct travellers so that if they are caught there, or if they are found there, that they could do up to 2 years in prison for contempt of court. This is what Bristol City Council are up to. But as I was going to court on Tuesday morning, I was stopped going into the court and by a Sudanese guy. And he says, in my country, we have no COVID-19 deaths, hardly at all. And I said, why is that? He said, chloroquine. We use chloroquine. And so it turns out that the Indian manufacturers of chloroquine were sending loads and loads of supplies over to Africa. And he's quite right. I had a look online, and I put a link up to it on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Whilst Europe and the United States were banning chloroquine, effectively stopping people using it, although Trump used it, Africa and Asia were using it to stop COVID-19, which at the time was originally was called SARS-CoV-2. So that's my two halfpence worth. I just ask for closing comments, closing statements or whatever from all of you. We'll start again with you, Kate, and end with you, Delia.
Right. Well, it's just easy for me. Do your research, stand up for your rights, and it's easy. Don't consent. Just do not consent. Think of your future and freedom. Simple, easy. Do not consent. End of.
You need to be able to exercise your freedoms even during a deadly pandemic. If you're healthy, if you think you are fine, then nobody should have the right to stop you from living your life.
And I agree with my learned friends here, because they are learned, because they've gone and done their own research, which is what I've done as well, which is just to say no, to switch off the television, just switch it off. Don't watch it. It is poison.
Cancel your BBC license.
Yes, also
license.
Netflix.
Defund the BBC.
Defund the BBC, yes. Turn off the television. Just say no and just do not consent.
Well, stay happy, stay positive and live your life.
I mean, I might be sounding a bit arrogant, but I think we as anti-lockdown protest group are actually do have the intellectual high ground here, that we've actually thought these things through, whereas other people haven't.
Critical thinking seems to be dead.
And it's been killed a lot in the universities and the schools as well. But one quote from Hitler's private secretary, Martin Bormann, who was I've done a lot of research to suggest that he was brought to England at the end of the Second World War because he had
Paperclip.
He had the key to, well, that was the States, but he had the keys to the bank accounts from Nazi Germany. Around about $1 billion in 1945 was a lot of money, and the British commandos brought him to the UK, and he eventually ended up in South America. But Bormann said, every educated person is a future enemy.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. And we're being shut down. Anyone who has a different view, who looks into things, who's critically thinking, gets shut down. Ask yourself why.
And remember, fear makes you easier to control.
Okay, yes. Well, we'll be having Martin Summers, who's been patiently waiting in the background, after we have our break, and we're going to have some music from World War II, appropriately. World War II has been mentioned a few times here in the run-up to the Second World War. Maybe we're in a similar kind of situation now.
Wonderful, thank you.
Top of your head to the tip of your toes, you're beautiful. Yes, and baby, what's more, life is heavenly in your caress. From the top of your head to the tip of your toes, you're wonderful. You're the hit of the show, you're the cameo of loveliness. Oh, what eyes you have, oh, what lips you have, oh, what lovely features. Talk about adorable creatures. You have so many thrillables that I'm all out of syllables. From the top of your head to the tip of your toes, you're marvelous, glorious. You are simply divine. Top to tip, you're tip-top, but to top it all, you're mine. Thank you.
you linger like a haunting refrain, and I find you spinning round in my brain like the bubbles in a glass of champagne. You go to my head like a sip of sparkling burgundy brew, and I find the very mention of you like the kicker in a julep or two. The thrill of the thought you might give a thought to my plea casts a spell over me. Still I say to myself, get a hold of yourself, can't you see that it never can be? You go to my head with a smile that makes my temperature rise like a summer with a thousand Julys. You intoxicate my soul with your eyes. Though I'm certain that this heart of mine hasn't a ghost of a chance in this crazy romance. You go to my head. You go to my head.
That is from pre-World War II, actually, a medley with Carol Gibbons from 1935 and Joe Loss from 1938. A couple of lovely tunes there we don't get to hear enough on the BBC. Maybe people wouldn't want to tear up their license fees if they did play stuff like that a little bit more. Anyway, welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Thanks very much to Kate, Julie and Delia. You heard in the first part there. This time, though, we're looking at the Biden election, talking to journalist George Samueli, who writes for RT, about what this will mean for Europe and the rest of the world. Will we see wars breaking out? What will Biden mean for the Iran nuclear deal, the only piece of paper standing between us and Armageddon, some say, and also Hong Kong legislators resigning en masse, exactly what the Chinese, one would have thought, wanted them to do. They want them out of the way, don't they? But no, the Chinese saying this is a terrible thing to do and protesting about it themselves. And also Princess Diana, her panorama interview 25 years on. The Panist managed this week to spin it as a story about how terrible the now BBC head of religious broadcasting, Martin Bashir, is and was, never missing an opportunity for a vendetta. Will the new Director General, Tim Davey, from PepsiCo, do the right thing and defend Martin for doing his job? We shall see. And after The Traitors of Arnhem last week, the publication of another book of mine this week, which was commissioned and paid for, this time by Triney Day in Oregon, but not published. After not getting it published for such a long time, the main thing to do, of course, just publish it as a PDF. And it's here for free as of tonight on PDF. My look at the war on God and a war on us all through some of the best articles I wrote for RT, including The Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy. That's why it's called my second book in 2 weeks, the free watermarked on PDF, entitled The Siege of Heaven. And it's tied closely in with the occupation of true spirituality and religion over thousands of years. Also then, Anton Chaitkin finally rounding off proceedings tonight appropriately with a look at the origins of Pentecostalism and the charismatic movement in the mind control programs of the CIA and the Tavistock Institutes. Anton is the son of Jacob Chaitkin, who was the chief strategist and legal representative for the Jewish American boycott of Nazi Germany during the Second World War, but mainly before the Second World War. But anyway, Martin, welcome back. You got any comments about what you just heard there? With long discussions about protests in Stroud, tomorrow here in Bristol, and what they're calling lockdown light being going on for 4 weeks at the moment, and no political protests are allowed. In the first lockdown, which was supposed to be much more stringent during the peak of the Gombert's curve in March and April, there were provisions for protests. In fact, I think you went along on one yourself, but now they seem to have forgotten to put that into this second lockdown.
Well, we will see what happens. What we felt in the summer with the murder of George Floyd was that we couldn't leave a protest. We had to protest there and then, because otherwise it would be too late. So I think lots of people who went to the protest realised that this was a special event. Most people were attempting to social distance and most people were wearing masks. So I don't think there are hard and fast rules about these things.
Well, I would say in Stratford Park in Stroud last Saturday, there was over socially distanced, big spaces apart, but the police just kind of said they were going to close it down anyway. In fact, it was probably about 15, 20 minutes the speakers were allowed to carry on, and then one of them just walked off and then got arrested. And, of course, that was the end of things where there's no speakers or microphone left. Anyway, what about this? The way do you think that the Black Lives Matter movement earlier this year played into the US election? It must have made a bit of a difference.
Yes, surely. It clearly made a difference because Biden, if the figures are to be believed, and of course they're being disputed, has got the biggest vote for a presidential candidate ever. And it's quite clear that large numbers of that are from younger black people who generally don't participate in elections. And because of the higher political atmosphere created by what's been happening, they participated. And of course, that's what's put Georgia into play, because it's got a big black population there, many of whom have been denied the voting rights for many years. And of course, in January the 20th, I think it is, there's going to be a runoff for the two Senate seats there. And if the Democratic Party in Georgia, which have now registered lots and lots of young black people to vote, win, then they will control the Senate. So it's actually quite a lot to play for there.
The Biden election, I did talk to George Samueli about this, and we'll be hearing from him in a minute. But what do you think, the other major thing for us, I suppose, is how do you think it might impact on or not on Brexit? Because it's all happening at the same time, supposedly, isn't it?
Well,
the end of January, Biden comes in, beginning of January, Brexit.
Well, I think the main chatter about this is in relation to whether Boris Johnson is going to do a deal this week or beginning of next week with the EU. If Trump had won, he might have been emboldened to just say, we're not going to do a deal.
Trump is still in charge, isn't he, until the end of January?
Yeah, but of course he won't. But the point is, looking forwards, the chance of getting if they've got to get a trade deal, they've got to get it before the end of April. Yeah? So if, as it looks, Biden will be in charge, they won't get a trade deal before the end of April. And I don't think Trump can deliver a trade deal before the end of April. And that means that any trade deal will then, in any case, has to go through the Congress. So, what people are suggesting, I'm not saying whether this is true or not, I'm just saying what the chatter is that he's under more pressure to do a deal now of some sort, rather than to do no deal at all.
What do you make of the sackings over the last day or so, with Dominic Cummings announcing he's out? I mean, surely the indication here is that he was a Brexiteer, that maybe he's out because he doesn't want to be associated with whatever happens at the end of the year.
Well, it may be that what's happening is behind the scenes, which we can't see. There's a big row going on about whether they're going to do a deal or not. And we will find out, I mean, what's going to happen. And the kind of deal that they will do, I think what from the EU's point of view, they're likely to dig their heels in now. They're going to say basically it's take it or leave it from our point of view. And if Boris takes it, then he will then face pressure from his own side not to sign up to the deal. And you could find a situation developing in which Starmer and Boris push through a deal which the right wing of the Tory party votes against. I'm not saying that's going to happen. It's just one of the possibilities.
Well, one of the things I'd like to do on our show page later at thisweek.org.uk is share a graphic with you, which is looking at some of the various factions here. So number 10, Svengali, they call him, Dominic Cummings, is married to The Spectator's commissioning editor, Mary Wakefield. The communications chief, Lee Kane, who's just gone, data guru Ben Walker, Brexit advisor Oliver Lewis and Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove are all part of one faction, what they call the Blue Faction. And on the other side, there's Boris's girlfriend, Carney Simmons, the face of number 10 briefings, Allegra Stratton, who's going to be the Prime Minister's spokesperson. It's becoming a very Americanized system, isn't it? The idea that Allegra Stratton steps in front of the cameras and tells us what Boris is thinking that day.
Yeah, well, I think what happened was Boris was getting, you know, it was getting increasingly embarrassing. So the same with Trump. So that's why they brought Kayleigh McEnany in, because she's, you know, basically more photogenic than Trump, and she can take the hits. And I think that's what the thinking was. It is basically copying the Yanks.
Okay, so also part of the other faction, which is supposedly spearheaded by Carrie Simmons, is the number 10 policy chief, Muneera Mirza, the Chancellor, Richie Sunak, who's obviously from Goldman Sachs, and the Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth. So, but the interesting thing about this is the two work together. So you've got, on the one hand, with the old regime, the Spectator's commissioning editor, Mary Wakefield, and then the new regime, married to Allegra Stratton, is the Spectator's political editor, James Forsyth. So it almost seems like we've got a tiny little, you know, coterie of people, maybe you could even say a cult, running things.
Yeah, well, I mean, these people are all move in the same right-wing circles, don't they? I mean, it's not that surprising that they're all related to each other. Of course, Muneera Mirza used to be in the Revolutionary Communist Party, and there were some questions about whether she should be,
Do you know what immediately comes to mind when you say that? MI5.
Yeah, well, we always thought the Revolutionary Communist Party was a front. And, of course, I sent you a thing this week about the inquiry into the spy cops. And it's quite clear that every left-wing group has been heavily infiltrated for years. They were saying that the 1968 before the 1968 demonstration, there were 9 different spies in this meeting of 200 people. And they all had to have a vote about what they were going to do when they went to the demonstration. And the one guy who's testified said, well, I voted against the Maoists who wanted to march on Downing Street. And he said, well, why did you do that? He said, well, in my persona, I was supposed to be an anti-Maoist person, so I thought I'd better vote against them. And then the judge asked him, well, how did the other spies vote? And he said, well, I don't know how the other spies voted because I don't know who they were. So you've basically got all of these spies inside this public meeting, none of whom know who the other spies are.
So I'll put that graphic up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which might help you understand some of the different figures in and around number 10 and which factions they're part of and what their job is at the Spectator. The Spectator is turning into kind of a key player. It's also, I believe, Andrew Neil is one of the directors there from the BBC. He's one, you know, that just seem a lot of people are now gravitating around that. And actually, I suppose we should be reading that more these days if all these people are writing for it and running it.
Well, Boris Johnson used to write for it. It's basically the in-house gossip rag of the Tory party, with the New Statesman, of course, traditionally the Staggers being the Labour Party's equivalent. And you know, that's what you'd expect. It's a right-wing rag, and the New Statesman's a left-wing rag.
So we've also got news today, which I'm not sure if it's made the Nationals, but I was certainly very interested to see it earlier on, Martin, and that is that the chair and secretary of Bristol West Labour Party this morning were suspended.
Yep, that's because I was invited to a Zoom meeting to debate. What they hoped to do is that there wouldn't be a debate, they'd just have a vote. So they thought in those terms that they would not be breaking the edict from Stuff Central, as it were. And it looked like about 200 people participated.
Okay, so basically the Central Labour Party said that we don't want any debates about whether or not we should have suspended Jeremy Corbyn.
That's right.
So they said, well, we won't have a debate, we'll just have a vote. But then they were suspended anyway.
Yeah, and in actual fact, what's bizarre about this is that the vote was won by the pro-Jeremy Corbyn faction, but quite clearly, the MP, Thangam Debonair, and lots of her faction, who are not the Corbyn faction, participated in the meeting and voted against the motion that was being put. But of course, there's only 200 people participating in the meeting. It must have been about half and half pro-Corbyn and anti-Corbyn, but the membership is actually much, much bigger than that. And most of them did not participate in the meeting.
So did you participate?
No, I didn't.
Right, so hopefully you won't be suspended. But I mean, so surely, you know, this is a very strange way to run a political party, where you're telling people that they're not allowed to debate some of the main issues which are running through the party and people are discussing.
Well, that would be the position of the pro-Corbyn faction. And
are you one of those?
I suppose I would be called that, yeah. I think the point is that the suspension of Jeremy Corbyn was in itself, it looks as if that was actually decided in consultation with Starmer, who's the leader. Now, in that case, that's him interfering in what should be an independent process. So if he's going to do that, then, of course, the membership feel that they've got a right to speak out on it as well. And so, you know, you can see this row is escalating as we speak. And, you know, it's there's plenty more road
to run. So Chairwoman Dr. Hannah Little and Co-Secretary Darren McLaughlin were suspended today after constituency Labour Party members passed the motion which condemned the suspension of former party leader Jeremy Corbyn. The suspensions came after Labour's South West Regional Director Phil Gaskin and General Secretary David Evans advised that motions should not be heard at the meeting, according to the website Labour List. Bristol West MP and Shadow Housing Secretary Thangam Debonair said on Twitter that she attended the meeting, voted against at the meeting being held voted against the meeting being held and voted against the motion. So this is actually quite a big Labour Party, isn't it? We've got here.
Yeah, Bristol West is one of the biggest ones. Yeah,
where
in
the country?
The country, yeah.
Wow, amazing. So, what do you think is going to happen? What's your crystal ball? I don't want to get you sacked from the Labour Party for saying the wrong thing, Martin. But what do you think is going to happen here?
Well, I think there's clearly. I've been reading very useful stuff from Jewish Voice for Labour. If people want to look them up, you'll find they've got a website and they've got a newsletter. And they've been analysing it pretty thoroughly, actually. And in the report, it actually says that people saying that anti-Semitism has been exaggerated for political reasons, people saying that are explicitly protected from being disciplined. So it's actually in the report that people are allowed to say that. So Jeremy Corbyn has said that, but that's actually in the report itself. It says people who say this should not, you know, this
is a
legitimate point of view.
You know what, this is wonderful for the Tories, isn't it?
Of course it is, and of course that's the problem, which is that the sabotage of the Labour Party by the pro-Israel faction, which is what it is, basically... it creates huge problems for the socialist left in the Labour
Party.
These
accusations of anti-Semitism tend to get lost in this kind of bun fight. But anyway, one of the people who's spoken out is, I believe, a Labour Party member. He's the former ANC Member of Parliament, Jewish guy from South Africa, Andrew Feinstein, and he's had this to say about the suspension of Jeremy Corbyn.
I was not only extraordinarily honoured to serve under Nelson Mandela, as a person who had nothing but privilege being born under apartheid in South Africa, as the son of a Holocaust survivor who lost 39 members of her family at Auschwitz and Theresienstadt, I was also the first member of parliament in the history of the South African parliament to introduce a motion on the Holocaust. I have had the privilege of writing about and lecturing about genocide prevention at Auschwitz itself, so was able to see where my relatives were murdered. But I personally am here as a Jewish member of the Labour Party to say that Jeremy Corbyn is as much a racist or an anti-Semite, as was my former boss, Nelson Mandela. And it is because of their lifelong commitment to anti-racism that united them in their opposition to apartheid in South Africa, to the brutal, illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories, and to all violations of human rights wherever they occurred, and whomsoever perpetrated them. The Jewish community in Britain is, like all communities, wonderfully diverse, religiously, culturally, and of course politically. There are hundreds of Jewish members of the Labour Party who unequivocally support Jeremy Corbyn and his handling of anti-Semitism. There are swathes of members of the broader Jewish community, including a significant number of Orthodox rabbis who support Jeremy Corbyn and his handling of anti-Semitism and all racism. But there is an attempt by the mainstream media in this country, and very sadly at the moment, by the leadership of the Labour Party, to wish away left-wing Jews, to behave as though we do not exist and should not therefore have a voice. That is an attempt to do away with the extraordinary tradition of Jewish socialism and support for liberation movements from Pretoria to Palestine. In fact, I would argue that the mainstream media and the right wing of the Labour Party have exhibited the most extreme manifestation that I have come across. And remember, this is in the age of Donald Trump, the most extreme manifestation of what Edward Said described as power repeating untruths until they have the force of truth. We will not and we cannot be silenced. We will not and cannot allow the truth to become untruth. As a consequence, a group of prominent Jews in the United Kingdom is considering launching a legal review of the EHRC report into anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. You can read about this and support it at truthdefence.org.
Well, you know what he reminds me of there, Martin, in a way, is what's been going on to Julian Assange, and the idea that that journalism, that truth is all going in the dustbin, and there's only one official line which is going to be spun.
It is very, very similar. But I think that Starmer may have actually miscalculated here. It's likely that he's not going to get an easy victory, and that he's going to be messier and messier. And what I would like,
to see, a form of sabotage of the party.
Well, it could be, but I mean, he's actually, you see, what from his, put yourself in Starmer's shoes. He's actually done quite well out of this because the mainstream media, he wants to draw a line under the previous leadership of the Labour Party.
He's surely making things worse, isn't it?
Well, what he's doing is he's basically playing up to the mainstream media trope that there is anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, which, of course, is largely not true. I mean, what Jeremy Corbyn was saying is that they did an opinion poll survey and asked people how many anti-Semites were in the Labour Party. Most people who weren't members of the Labour Party said, oh, it must be at least 30%. And he said, in actual fact, it's less than 0.3%. So it's a massive difference, you know, that have been...
I mean, at some point, surely, many of these socialist groups of MPs, supporters, members of the Labour Party are going to leave.
Lots of people have resigned. And of course, from Starmer's point of view, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Although what we've just had is an internal ballot for the National Executive Committee. And we don't know the results yet. It'll be interesting to see what they are, because I suspect that there's going to be pretty much a clean sweep for the pro-Corbyn faction. Because many pro-Corbyn people voted for Starmer. I'm one of them. And he cannot presume that because we voted for him, that we're going to give up our basic orientation. And I suspect that the NEC elections are going to show that. But of course, a lot of people have resigned. And from Starmer's point of view, that's good riddance to bad rubbish as far as he's concerned. He wants to go back to the old style of top-down Labour politics, where he just talks to the media and tries to reach out to the wider society, as he would see it, and that the Labour Party just becomes an electoral machine for electing him. And I think that he's going to find that in actual fact, the mass Labour Party that's been created over the last 5 years isn't just going to disappear.
I mean, this is also going to be good for the Greens, though, isn't it? A lot of people are looking at Labour saying, what a shambles.
In
our local elections
In Bristol West, where we are now, the Greens are the challengers insofar as there are challengers to the Labour Party. Although in actual fact, the Labour Party did very well here, even with the Greens as the second choice. A lot of Labour Party members could go green, but I mean, a lot of Labour Party members aren't necessarily green, so they won't necessarily go in that direction. And I think the other thing is that the Green Party has also bought in, like other all the parties that are not the Labour Party have decided to buy into this idea of accusing the Labour Party of being anti-Semitic as a means of trying. I mean, we've had Green spokespeople on this show, and they've basically, however, you know, with whatever caveats, bought into this idea that the Labour Party is anti-Semitic. Now, in that case,
well, that's the sort of herd instinct. Though, it is. Well, it is. I mean, if you can see that the animal, it looks like it's dying. You know, that's then right. Someone will come and also take
and
a bite.
And of course, the Greens will say that, you know, join us. We're not anti-Semitic or whatever.
It doesn't say a lot for you know.
I wasn't very impressed when they said things like that. The Green candidate.
We've been talking in the first part of the program a lot about people losing their rights under these measures, and it's quite important that you know there are. There was remembrance services this last Sunday and on the 11th, on Wednesday too. So I was quite shocked to see. In fact, many veterans were told that you're not allowed to come to a remembrance services, which is a bizarre thing to be saying to people maybe in the last years of their life. But Edinburgh News has reported, and various other places, although not much elsewhere, that the police were filmed pushing a kilted bagpiper to the ground at a veterans protest. So this is on last Sunday. Police are investigating after a video emerged which appears to show officers pushing a kilted piper to the ground near a Remembrance Sunday event. I would have thought this should be reported all over the country. The footage which is circulating on social media, and I'll put a link up to this article in Edinburgh News up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, shows a man in Scottish dress playing the bagpipes in the Whitehall area of London near the Cenotaph. Maybe this is something that the Scots are getting in their newspapers, but not the English due to censorship. The confrontation happened at a protest about the impact of strict coronavirus restrictions on marking Remembrance Sunday events. In the capital, police can be seen forming a wall, preventing protesters, some of whom are understood to be veterans, from passing. However, the piper, who's initially playing close to the police line, turns to try and step past officers who are seen to push him away. The kilt-clad man falls to the floor and a confrontation ensues. A spokeswoman for the Met Police told the Scotsman, "Police are aware of a video circulating which shows an officer using force after a man had tried to enter a restricted area in Whitehall, South West 1. Now, this sort of thing, Martin, is pretty shocking, isn't it? Where you've got someone who looks like they're probably a veteran of some sort there, trying to do Remembrance Sunday, but the whole thing being shut down by the police.
Well, I don't know what actually happened in this particular incident, and I haven't seen the video, but the police are always very, very, you know, I tried to protest outside the Cenotaph years ago, and the police jumped all over me straight away because they said it's a national monument, you're not allowed to stand there, all sorts of things. And that was on an ordinary day, not on a day when the Cenotaph is being, because there was obviously a ceremony, but lots of,
it's,
you know,
in a way,
the normal
symbolic
crowd didn't
isn't this
turn up.
Symbolic though, the people, and Remembrance Sunday, remembering people that died for our freedoms, and on that day someone who's trying to remember it is pushed to the floor and injured by police.
Were they protesting about coronavirus?
They were protesting because they were told that they weren't allowed to come to the Remembrance.
All right, well, I don't know enough about this particular incident, what the motivation of the piper was, what the police actually
did. We'll put up a link, so it's very hard to comment, isn't it?
But,
I mean, surely this is, Martin, you could surely comment about the lack of freedoms at a Remembrance protest.
No, I will say this, because we've just had over an hour and a half of people going on about freedom to demonstrate or whatever. There is, in fact, no absolute right to demonstrate in this country, or any country. And people may say that there is, but there isn't. And, of course, there has been a decision. I mean, can you imagine if the Blitz was on?
You sound like the voice of the Gestapo.
No, I'm just pointing out what the law actually is. All that stuff about common law earlier, basically nonsense. It's not legal basis. There's no legal basis for any of that whatsoever. The idea that you've got these laws, you know, you draw your rights in the US Constitution, it's all in there. We inherit these rights from God or whatever. In this country, our rights derived from the common law, which was put into place by Henry II a long time ago. And in actual fact, there's all sorts of legal, that's why we have a whole legal apparatus with barristers and judges and all the rest of it. And you can't just wish it all away by waving a magic wand. And the police actually have the power to stop demonstrations and to make decisions on public order grounds, as they do in Northern Ireland all the time.
Are they going to be able to do that? Well, I mean, the obvious caveat here is that they may be able to do this indefinitely now, with lockdown after lockdown and virus after virus.
Well, and the banking collapse, and then the war. When we go to war with Iran, they may decide that we've all got to stay at home and all the rest of it. You know, that we're in a massive social crisis.
You seem to be justifying it.
No, I'm not justifying it. I'm just pointing out that the actual rules are that the police can make decisions on operational grounds.
You mentioned the...
which may or may not be correct.
You mentioned the undercover police inquiry earlier. That's, I mean, very important. Just this week, we had the Stephen Lawrence family criticising the undercover policing inquiry. Mm. Parents of murdered teenager Stephen Lawrence are losing confidence in the public inquiry into undercover policing, their lawyers say. In an opening statement for Baroness Doreen Lawrence, Imran Khan QC, said that the campaigner had doubts that the inquiry would reveal why her family were spied on. I mean, this is a police state they're talking about here, and we've also had this law about covert sources surveillance, which means that apparently police covert sources are allowed to murder people and rape them with impunity. So, I mean, this does all start to look like more like a police state, particularly with what we saw, the stopping of protest in Stroud, even though people were socially distanced, and the police saying that there's no right to protest tomorrow here on College Green.
There's always been a police state in this country. The police, this is the Metropolitan Police Special Demonstration Squad, have been infiltrating and manipulating left-wing movements in this country for 40 years.
Okay, so what can be done about the police spy cops then?
Well, the inquiry is going ahead. Some new information is coming out as a result of it. You're quite right to pick up on the laws.
Well, actually, Stephen Lawrence's family is saying basically, no, it isn't. They're just stalling.
No, it isn't what?
The information is not coming out.
No, okay, yes, some information is coming out, but of course the inquiry itself has got an establishment judge ahead of it.
I mean,
things will be brushed under the
carpet. If I can paraphrase what the Lawrence family seem to be saying here, is that there is no rule of law, really, in Britain.
There never was, Tony. So when people go on, we've got to stand up for our freedoms that we're losing, I feel like saying, what freedoms? We haven't. In Northern Ireland, there never were any freedoms.
Would you say the same to the suffragettes?
The point about all of this is there's always been a deep state in this country, and they've always basically run things and tried to manipulate things from behind the scenes. That's been going on forever.
Okay, so what can citizens do about that then?
Well, in Northern Ireland in 1969, they decided to take up arms and to resist the state with force. And sometimes that might be justified, Tony.
In what way?
I'm just saying that sometimes I'm not a pacifist. Tony, are you a pacifist?
Yeah, I'm a pacifist.
Okay, well, I'm not.
I mean, I'm a Quaker pacifist, basically, you know.
So ultimately, of course, what happens, from my point of view, Tony...
I mean, people have talked about a possible civil war coming out if these lockdowns and things like that continue on and on and on.
Well, if you look at the United States of America with this contested election and everybody armed to the teeth and people dying every day with gunshots, I mean, at Colombia, people are dying all the time. FARC have split now, and some of them have gone back to the mountains. That's the future for capitalism. There's going to be a collapse in social order, and people are going to be armed, and they're going to be fighting. And the only way around that is to develop a rule of law by working on peace agreements and so on, working with the police rather than against them, hopefully, as has happened in Northern Ireland, even though so many people have suffered so much.
Prime Minister's questions this week, the question of Joe Biden's election to President of the United States for another 4 years. I mean, it's a little bit in the balance because there are some challenges. Do you want us to say something quickly about that, Martin, about the Dominion software and other challenges that are being made to by Trump? Do you think it will get anywhere?
Well, I've been following everybody's stuff about this. It's been obviously in a very, very close election. And lots of people have participated. So that's the positive thing you could say. It's actually got them out there and got everybody involved.
Well, it's got them scribbling out postal forms anyway.
Well, whatever. I don't think that what the tactics are by Trump and his team is to raise as many questions as possible about the election. So they're not relying on one line of attack. They're trying any line of attack.
So what are some of the lines they've been trying?
Well, I mean,
electronic voting.
Well, they were going on about the postal votes. The postal votes was an obvious one because they flagged that up months ago that they were going to question the postal votes. And in Pennsylvania, which is a key state, the postal votes weren't allowed to be counted until all the walk-in votes had been counted. They could have started counting them weeks ago, but the Republicans...
what we do in this country, don't we?
Yeah, we start counting.
I think
counting
it's a few days before.
That's right, but what the Republicans who run the Pennsylvania... the House in Pennsylvania, they voted that they wouldn't actually count postal ballots until... after the walk-in ballots have been counted. So what's happened is that the Republicans have set up... Dr. Jack Rasmus has done a very good analysis of all of this. If anybody has interest, you can look it up on his website. So they already planned what they were going to do, and Trump was saying that but he didn't trust postal ballots and his people were to go and vote in person, which they largely did. The Democrats were saying because of coronavirus and all the rest of it, we prefer, we want people to vote on using postal ballots, and that's what they did. And then they won't count the postal ballots until the walk-in ballots have been counted. Now that means that the initial count would look like it was in favour of Trump, but when you start counting the postal ballots, it starts to change.
And this is why some of the swings may be. Anyway, let's have go back to Wednesday's Prime Minister's questions where this came up in the Commons.
Ms. Lurie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister spoke for many of us when he took a call yesterday to congratulate President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris on their emphatic win in the US presidential election. So does the Prime Minister now have any advice for his erstwhile best friend, President Trump, whose continuing refusal to accept the result is both embarrassing for him and dangerous for American democracy?
Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I had and have a good relationship with the previous president. I do not resile from that. It is the duty of all British prime ministers to have a good relationship with the White House. But I'm delighted to find the many areas in which the incoming Biden Harris administration is able to make common cause with us. In particular, it was extremely exciting to talk to President-elect Biden about what he wants to do with the COP26 summit next year, Mr. Speaker, in which, as you know, the UK is leading the world in driving down carbon emissions and tackling climate change.
Well, I mean, basically, Boris is doing the usual that he does, which is avoiding the question he's been asked and just trying to answer a question of his own devising. He was in a difficult position because obviously if Trump had won and he held back from accepting what was going on, and now the momentum is moving against him and he's changed his tune.
Anyway, let's have a listen now to George Samueli, see what he has to say about Biden. I particularly wanted to hear what he thought was going to be the difference in the relations between Europe and the United States, and also, of course, some of the major potential flashpoints around the world. Does he think that the Biden administration... Actually, maybe, Mark, before we hear from George, Martin, what do you think the foreign policy changes might be? Is it more likely that we'll get wars under Biden or less, or is it all exactly the same?
It's pretty much the same. The policies are decided by the deep state. The president is effectively a figurehead. That is the truth of the matter.
Okay, so let's have a listen to what RT columnist and journalist George Samueli had to say about Biden's election.
As far as the Europeans are concerned, they didn't like Trump because he was a disturber of the cozy arrangement that they had for decades. But I think they weren't bad years for Europe. I mean, because basically... Trump just allowed the Europeans to do what they wanted to do, pursue their own interests while America pursued its interests. With Biden, I think he's going to try to re-energize NATO, which means he's going to try and cajole America's NATO partners into joining these various NATO projects. I mean, it's now looking like the Republicans will... control the Senate. They will continue to control the Senate. I mean, they now have 50 votes. They only need to win one of the two races in Georgia in January. They should easily be able to do that. Which means Republicans retain control of the Senate. The Democrats' majority in the House is much diminished. Essentially, any domestic agenda that Biden may have is dead on arrival. He's not going to be able to pass any domestic legislation, which means what happens in those circumstances, he will become the foreign policy president. And that was always likely because foreign policy was always kind of his interest. And what's he going to do with foreign policy? Well, he will make life very difficult for Russia, because the Democrats are absolutely like they're just like mad dogs when it gets to the subject of Russia. They're still convinced that the 2016 election was stolen from them by the Kremlin. And that's where Biden will focus, which means that he's going to revive the war in Syria, and thus, you know, again, helping the sort of the jihadis in Syria. He will probably get himself involved in the Caucasus, although now that there's been this peace signed between Armenia and Azerbaijan, that may be more difficult, but not impossible, because it doesn't sound like anybody's terribly happy. Neither Armenia nor Azerbaijan is terribly happy with this peace agreement. You could easily see the United States getting involved there. And Ukraine is his is Biden's baby. It was the Obama administration that engineered that coup in 2014. Biden was the point man on Ukraine. It was Biden's son that made millions through this coup in Ukraine. He will, without question, get himself involved in Ukraine. Probably again, he will try to revive some of the sort of the wars in the Caucasus and Chechnya and so on. I think that that's going to be the focus of the Biden administration. And so the Europeans, who are now rejoicing like Boris Johnson, that, oh, now we've got someone talking our language, you know, talking about climate change and democracy and human rights. I think they're going to soon be regretting this, you know, because I think it's going to be a very dangerous state of affairs. Because Russia may itself be undergoing a transition. You know, they may be moving towards a new leadership in the next year or two, which means that there could be quite an unstable situation. And if these nutcases, who I think are going to come to power with Biden, Michel Flournoy, Susan Rice, Samantha Power, Nicholas Burns, and Tony Blinken, these people, these are absolute, you know, neocons through and through. You have these people in power running their anti-Russian foreign policy. And if there is instability in Russia, then I think it could well be just an explosive mixture.
So that's George Samueli there, Martin. I mean, George is saying what you're not saying. He thinks that there will be more foreign policy moves of various sorts, maybe new wars breaking out under Biden than would have happened under Trump.
Well, I think he's right that Biden is very anti-Russian. But the presumption that Trump wasn't anti-Russian is simply wrong. I mean, the Democrats have got, you know, just talk to themselves about this. They've convinced themselves that somehow Trump was pro-Russian. That's not how it's perceived in Russia. I think basically they recognise that the deep state in the US is absolutely hostile to them, and it doesn't really matter who wins.
What do you make of the, you know, Sleepy Joe and Kamala? Because it does look as if, you know, he's just basically there to read a script. And we know, at least with Trump, you knew that you were getting what Trump thought, and he wasn't just reading from a Hollywood script. It looks like we're going to have kind of Hollywood politics now for the next 4 years.
Well, we had Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. And, you know, they were basically not in charge. So
I think
that's normal.
Reagan is definitely a comparison, because they just seem to be reading stuff out. So Kamala Harris is a bit of a Keir Starmer, isn't she? In that she's a former state prosecutor who made sure that various powerful people could just press buttons and stop prosecutions.
Well, she is an establishment friendly candidate. And what the right wing of the Democratic Party would say, as the right wing of the Labour Party here, is we've got to have establishment-friendly candidates if we're going to win. We can't take, you know, we can't push a radical message because we'll lose if we do, etc. I think that's not quite true, because it's quite clear that lots of younger, more radical people have voted for Biden because they hate Trump so much. But that doesn't mean that Trump, that you can take them for granted as permanent supporters. The problem with the US electoral system, like the British electoral system, is that the left is constantly in a cul-de-sac. Because if they don't play the game as set up by the establishment, they can't get a look in to get any handle on power. But by doing that, they then have to give up all of the things that they'd like to achieve. And of course, what they need is electoral reform, which is possible in Britain, but virtually impossible in the US, because you've got to get a two-thirds majority through the Congress and the Senate to change anything, which of course you can't get. So you're stuck with this pig in a poke of a system.
Okay, well, let's move to look at Hong Kong now, because amazing scenes yesterday as the entire pro-democracy, pro-Hong Kong legislature resigned. Four of their members were sacked by Carrie Lam, who's the chief executive of Hong Kong under the orders of Beijing. So a lot of them have gone now, Martin. Do you think that's a wise tactic? Because the Chinese are saying, in Beijing are saying, that they think this is a terrible thing to do. But actually, of course, they don't really want these people hanging around, do they?
Well, it's a matter for those concerned to decide whether they're going to resign in solidarity with those who've been excluded. I think the Chinese position is pretty clear all along, is that we are the bosses here, and we will tolerate to some extent you having a different setup from the mainland China, but when it push comes to shove, we decide, and that's how it's going to be.
Do you think there's any point in people in Hong Kong thinking, actually, we don't want to be ruled by Beijing? Do they have to just give up and go home?
Well, they are home, aren't they?
No, I mean, you know, give up on the trying to keep the rights. I mean, for example, one of, you know, this is an important right which we're complaining about being gotten rid of, free speech here in Britain, through the getting rid of Julian Assange, etc., mass censorship on the mass media about the coronavirus. But in Hong Kong, it's okay, because we're just going to have to suck it up.
Well, I mean, what does it say in Thucydides? The weak suffer what they must. The strong do what they will and the weak suffer what they must. There is no way that China is going to tolerate a breakaway Hong Kong. They're just not going to tolerate it. It would be very similar for us in Bristol to say we're going to break away from the United Kingdom.
So this is a kind of David and Goliath struggle. Yeah. That you think that they can't, the Hong Kong people just have no chance of winning it?
Well, I think what I would suggest is that there are definitely, they've basically got far more scope to protest and to say what they think in Hong Kong than they have elsewhere in China. And the Chinese government basically thinks that they're spoilt brats, and that, you know, you've got more freedom to speak and loads more scope to do what you want than anybody else.
But of course, they're looking at, for example, we covered it comprehensively last week with Charles Yuang, who's the chairman of the Hong Kong Journalists Association, mm-hmm. talking about the attack, the Luang Wing, I can never pronounce it, the triad attack, basically, last July, where all these pro-democracy demonstrators were getting off a tube train or a railway train, and they were just consistently beaten up over about half an hour with these triad guys with iron bars or metal bars, beating these people up, hospitalising about 50 of them, leaving loads more just there on the ground, colluding with the police. I mean, this is official thuggery, isn't it, by Beijing?
Well, I'm not going to.
That's what this documentary is implying. It's saying, look, you've got Julius Ho, who's a pro Beijing lawmaker in Hong Kong, shaking hands with the triads afterwards.
Well, I don't know enough about that particular incident to comment.
This is what, wait, Martin, you don't need to know any more. Surely people in Hong Kong are watching this and thinking, well, we're not going to be putting up with a government, however powerful they might be, that are just simply using the police to beat people up like that. And then that means that there's no rule of law in Hong Kong either.
Well, there's no rule of law anywhere in one sense.
So it's just
there?
Survival of the fittest now, which is it? And that we just have to shrug our shoulders and say it's survival of the fittest. Sorry.
All right. The political situation is such that those who wish to make Hong Kong independent of China are not going to find that they're going to have an easy road to hoe. They're not. And of course, the British government in the form of Dominic Raab has promised them, several million of them, that they can come to Britain, which is an extraordinary thing for him to promise, having just won a referendum and a general election on the grounds that we've got to stop freedom of movement into the country. But of course, when it comes to our imperial past and our imperial pretensions, millions of Chinese can come here, apparently. I don't know how that's going to play out, or whether they should be... I don't think at the end of the day the British government will allow them to come.
Well, Benedict Rogers, they're
basically talking out of two sides of their mouth, aren't they?
Journalist Benedict Rogers is saying that there are several ways that it could go in Hong Kong. The first is that these decisions this week may reignite the radicals. He's saying also that another option is that maybe Hong Kong people are just going to have to surrender. And the third option, he says, is going to be exile. People are just going to have to get out. Their fourth option is to stay but fight in more creative, subtle, careful and peaceful ways.
Well, the fourth option, what was always possible is with the beginning of the protest movement some while ago, there was some tolerance from the mainstream Chinese government because you've got to make demands which they can give into. If you demand more democracy, not full democracy, more democracy, and you were also to make it clear that we're not going to push for independence of Hong Kong, you could probably have carved out a space for a more liberal Hong Kong regime, which would have been tolerated by Beijing because it wouldn't be seen as a threat. But unfortunately, because of the ongoing confrontation between the West and China, which is not just about Hong Kong is just one piece in a massive game of Go. So the more you find Hong Kong protesters, for example, some of them I saw today are siding with Trump against Biden. They carried British flags. They carried American flags. Now this is like red rag to bull.
Well, it's an appeal for help.
Yes, an appeal for help. But if they think that the British Army or the US Army is going to rescue them,
the Royal Navy,
they are deluded.
Well, we do have an aircraft carrier now, don't we?
I mean, what I would say to those people is do not trust that the West is basically manipulating your cause. They want you to make trouble for the Chinese because they want to make trouble for the Chinese. They should be advising you to try and find a middle way.
I think maybe option four is the best one. But is there another option? I suppose they could all join the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, that, if you think back to Tiananmen Square in 1979, lots of those people, the students who were demonstrating, their parents were the top leadership of the Chinese Communist Party. Ai Weiwei, who's very anti the current Chinese government, his family were Communist Party. And of course, in China itself, there's a long tradition of going back before the communist regime into imperialist times, that you're allowed to criticize the government provided you are loyal. That is a kind of cultural, and the government also must take account of genuine criticisms from those who are loyal. Now, that is actually the way things work. It's the way things work in Singapore, for example. There are elections, but the government always wins. And it's quite common in Southeast Asia. It's not just in communist China that you have this kind of collectivist attitude.
I mean, the real danger over there, of course, is the United States seem to be trying to ignite a war by their actions, and it's just not helping people in Hong Kong. The US, obviously, they kidnapped, basically, or got the Canadians to kidnap the chief financial officer of Huawei, who's now still in prison in Canada, which didn't help things. So maybe there is something that the Americans could do to take the heat off these poor people in Hong Kong. One of the things that isn't going to, of course, is Biden's Pentagon transition team, whose members are all funded by the arms industry. And investigations found a third of the team worked actually directly for organizations that get money straight from the weapons makers. Joe Biden released a list of transition teams for the various departments in his future White House. The Pentagon transition team for Biden has 23 people in, many of whom hail from these hawkish think tanks funded by the arms industry.
Well, that's right. I mean, from a progressive perspective, the Biden regime, if we can call it that, is going to be...
I think we can call it a regime.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to be as confrontational with China and Russia as was the previous setup. And, of course, we're all bowling towards a banking collapse and, of course, some miscalculation in the Gulf or elsewhere could lead to a shooting war.
I mean, it's just point listeners towards the marvellous John Pilger documentary, The Coming War on China, which is about 2 hours long, but is an absolutely shocking indictment of US policy over the last decades surrounding China, provoking China, basically making it absolutely clear that we're coming to get you. It doesn't really help the situation. And it also, Martin, this week, it's not the greatest time for stories to be circulating about Vladimir Putin having Parkinson's and maybe having to step down.
Well, I hadn't noted that. He was going to step down anyway. I mean, the changing of the constitution was to make sure that there wasn't going to be some kind of hiatus in the situation. I mean,
isn't
in
it
Russia.
Not quite like Saudi Arabia, is it? Russia. What do you think will happen once Putin does go? If he dies, or if he's got an illness or whatever?
I think what will happen is that the general direction of Russian policy will remain the same. It isn't a one-man regime, much as the West likes to think of it as such. It's presented as this kind of dictatorship by Putin. Putin is, in fact, a committee leader. He's basically got lots of other people who do most of the heavy lifting. Shoigu, the defense minister, has been there nearly as long as Putin. Lavrov, the foreign minister, has been there nearly as long as Putin.
I mean, the son.
You've got Sergei Glazyev as one of the advisors there.
I hate to quote the son, sort of Cummings
in the situation.
I hate to quote the son, Martin, but the son is saying that Russia could collapse like a house of cards if Putin fails to find a successor.
Yeah, well, that's just Western wishful thinking. You know, what they had in Boris Yeltsin was a cat's paw for the Western interests. And in the past, they've looked to Medvedev to be the Western candidate. But because of the hostile attitude that there is a pro-Western faction in Russian politics, but they have been marginalised by the attitude of Western politicians, which has been consistently hostile. And of course, all of these intelligence service provocations, you know, the Skripal affair, the Navalny affair, all of these things are basically made, you know, the pro-Western faction in Russian politics have been completely marginalized because the West has been so unremittingly hostile. So I don't see that the West has got anything to hope for in terms of turning Russian politics in a pro-Western direction.
Anyway, the Telegraph is saying Putin's probably not going in January, but that won't stop the rumour mill. So there are these rumours been going along, but the Kremlin is denying Putin will quit as president, says he's in excellent health, and says he's not got Parkinson's disease.
It may very well be Brigade 77, etc., spreading exactly that sort of...
Operation Beluga,
Operation Beluga, which we know the name of it because of Paul Burrell, the former anti-terrorist squad officer.
At Brigade 77, they've probably got an Operation Beluga room there.
Yes.
I hope they're listening.
Well, yeah, but this is what they do. They have basically been sabotaging, using provocations of various kinds, including killing people, like the people who were shot in the Maidan Square were not shot by the police officers. They were shot by a NATO death squad, very similar to the sort of things we saw happening in Syria and in Venezuela. So they kill people. They kill pro-Western demonstrators in order to make Russia look bad.
Well, look,
that's how evil they are.
About Russian succession, and I imagine it's all going to be going steadily forward there, unlike maybe in the States, quite a lot of changes. But here in our very own royal family, we've been seeing stories circulating this week about some terrible person called Martin Bashir, the BBC's head of religious broadcasting, who the palace don't like, certainly St James's Palace don't like, and Buckingham Palace don't seem to like. Martin Bashir is the guy who 25 years ago interviewed Princess Diana for Panorama. They had a major problem, Martin, and that was that the lady in waiting for the Queen was married to the chairman of the BBC. So obviously they, as professional journalists, they had to make sure that he didn't find out about it. Otherwise, the palace would have stopped the Panorama. I mean, that's the sort of thing that would happen now. For example, the Jimmy Savile Panorama was stopped, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, and I think that that Panorama interview I mean, they're suggesting that Bashir carried out some kind of subterfuge to get the interview. I'm not quite sure. To be honest with you, I don't follow royal stories.
It was devastating. I think it was Monday and Tuesday this week. It was on ITV.
Yeah, but I mean, the point is that Princess Diana said what she wanted to say in that interview. And of course, it caused a lot of problems because she was speaking out of turn. She was saying stuff the royal family didn't want her to say and all the rest of it.
Well, you know what really came across to me in that interview is the way that it seemed that she was being psychologically tortured in that marriage. So by staying in that marriage, she was almost unable to function as a person because of the amount of really evilizing, this is the word I'd use, the way that the people around her were basically saw her as a basket case and treating her appallingly because she wasn't seen as one of the establishment.
Well, I mean, she made that pretty clear in the interview, didn't she? And that was what caused problems for the inner circle in the royal family.
We'll hear a little clip from the interview in a minute. But first of all, here's part of ITV's advert for the programme that went out earlier this week, Revenge of a Princess.
25 years since Diana's shocking interview with Martin Bashir.
This is the one that stabbed the monarchy in the heart.
We asked what really happened.
The chairman of the BBC was married to the Queen's lady-in-waiting. It was necessary to be secretive.
Hello, are you Paul?
I said yes. He said, I'm Martin. Get in the back seat and under the blanket and then I'll take you to Kensington Palace.
Diana opened the door. She said there were boys. Call me Diana.
The Diana interview, Revenge of a Princess, on ITV and ITV Hub.
So you don't watch this sort of stuff, Martin? You don't think it's important?
Well, I do, but I spend more time looking into things that have been on RT this week, talking about Nagorno-Karabakh. That's the sort of thing I read about.
Okay, but I mean, I find the shenanigans of the head of state in this country fascinating, particularly since we're being told that the Queen is retiring next April. Quite who's going to be taking over, whether it's Charles or William, is another question. But there seems to have been quite a lot of, you know, should we say fencing over who is going to get the limelight and the next April to take, you know, to be part of these decisions and also to be spokespeople, because two quite senior royals have been spun out over the last year, effectively character assassinated. One is Prince Harry, who's been made to look really silly by the woman he married, Meghan Markle, going over to the United States. And the other, of course, is Prince Andrew, Martin. So Prince Charles has pretty much got the field to himself.
Well, if he, you know, he's the next in line to the throne, and one presumes that he will be the next king.
He's also very much involved. Isn't it interesting how he's very involved, very much in this Great Reset, which is also timed for around about that time next year, beginning of next year, next spring. Prince Charles is also supposed to be leading the new economic system for the world, which is going to effectively take over from the IMF.
Well, if we're going to talk about the Great Reset, it's basically it's a lot of aspirations. They're basically saying that they want to change the system to make it fairer and all the rest of it. In actual practice, it's the same old, and none of it addresses the fundamental problem, which is that the financial services sector is going to collapse. So they're not going to reform the sector, it's just going to collapse. It can't be reformed.
Anyway,
it's too late.
The main reason I put the Diana programme on this programme is because of the immense amount of interest that there is in the light it throws on Prince Charles, who could take over from the Queen next April. So let's have a listen to a bit of that Panorama interview now from 25 years ago.
Do you think you'll ever be Queen?
No, I don't. No.
Why do you think that?
I'd like to be a queen of people's hearts, in people's hearts. But I don't see myself being queen of this country. I don't think many people would want me to be queen. Actually, when I say many people, I mean the establishment that I'm married into. Because they've decided that I'm a non-starter.
Why do you think they've decided that?
Because I do things differently. Because I don't go by a rule book. Because I lead from the heart, not the head. And albeit that's got me into trouble in my work, I understand that. But someone's got to go out there and love people and show it.
And do you think that because of the way you behave, that's precluded you effectively from becoming queen?
Yes, not precluded me, I wouldn't say that. I just don't think I have as many supporters in that environment than I did. Yeah.
You mean within the royal household?
Mm-hmm. They see me as a threat of some kind. and I'm here to do good. I'm not a destructive person.
Why do they see you as a threat?
I think every strong woman in history has had to walk down a similar path, and I think it's the strength that causes the confusion and the fear. Why is she strong? Where does she get it from? Where is she taking it? Where is she going to use it? Why do the public still support her? When I say public, you go in and do an engagement and there's a great many people there.
The sound of the music there is not mine. That was the only clip I could find with a bit of music in the background, which is actually quite annoying. That wasn't used in the original panorama. But the emotion there is absolutely palpable, Martin. It's somebody who's been forced into a situation where she's totally isolated within the establishment and all the people around her seem to hate her.
Yeah, and she wouldn't have got herself any favours by being interviewed by Panorama and coming out.
But
with
she
all
said
that
she's not going to go quietly. That's one of the things she said.
Well, she didn't, did she?
One of the things I found quite fascinating is the way that the Andrew Morton book, Dinah, Her True Story, which came out before the Panorama interview, the way that was put together was in a similar clandestine fashion. Quite a lot of stuff with Dinah had to be clandestine, because if the Royals found out what they were doing, they have the power to shut various things down, whether it's TV, documentaries, whatever, book publishing, using legal methods or using the security services, burgling, as a lot of that goes, as went on around the whole Dinah business. When that book, Andrew Morton's Dinah, Her True Story, was being written, the tapes that she wrote, or that she spoke into a tape recorder that Andrew Morton used to write the book, made absolutely fascinating listening. They'd never been heard, so far as I know, in this country, but they were aired in the United States. So I thought we'd have a listen now to a clip which we had put on this show probably 5 years ago, actually. But it's a fascinating insight, I think, into how Dinah started to challenge the way she was being treated by the royal family, and got over her bulimia and other things by literally going to a party where Camilla was and facing her down over the cheating of her in her marriage.
As Diana began to gain control over the bulimia, her strength returned, and so did her courage. She planned a confrontation with the other woman in her husband's life.
The voices I was there, just go for the hell of it. So I sat myself up something awful. This was my big step.
It was the winter of 1989. Charles and Diana were invited to a birthday party for Camilla's sister. Unexpectedly, Diana agreed to attend. Bodyguard Ken Wharf drove the couple to the party.
It was clear that Prince of Wales was unhappy that he was being accompanied by his wife. And I'm sure that Diana probably had a hidden agenda here.
After dinner, Diana noticed Charles had slipped away. She went downstairs and found Charles and Camilla talking to another guest.
I said to the two men, "Okay, boys, I'm just have a quick word with Camilla, and I'll be up in a minute." And they shot upstairs like chickens with no heads. And I could feel upstairs all hell breaking loose. What is she going to do?
Diana decided this was the moment to make it clear to Camilla that the royal marriage wasn't big enough for both women.
I was terrified of that. And I said, "I know what's going on between you and Charles. And I just want you to know that." And she said to me, very interesting, she said to me, "You've got everything you've ever wanted. You've got all the men in the world fall in love with you. And you've got two beautiful children. What more would you want?" So I said, "I want my husband." And I said to Camilla, "I'm sorry I'm in the way. And it must be hell for both of you. But I don't know what's going on. Don't trip me like an idiot."
Tension was high as Wharf drove the royal couple home that night.
I remember in the car that there was a debate between the two of them. Some of it seemed to be fairly hostile.
And in the car on the way back, my husband was over me like a bad rash. And I cried like I've never cried before. And it was anger. It was 7 years of pent-up anger coming out.
Diana called it one of the bravest moments of her entire 10 years of marriage.
And the next morning I woke up and I felt different. Shift. Tremendous shift. I'd done something, said what I felt. But there's still the old jealousy and the anger swirling around, but it wasn't so deathly as it had been before. And that was it, really. It was a big step for me.
There was a different princess, in the sense that she'd almost sort of triumphed over something that hitherto had been a huge problem for many, many years. And there was no doubt in my mind that this really signified the ending of a marriage.
Okay, so that's from, I believe it's Kitty Kelly that did that over in the United States. I don't think it's been aired at all in Britain, those tapes from Andrew Morton, for obvious reasons. You know, if the Royals get wind of that about to go out, then they may well want to stop it. Martin, what do you think is going to happen next April? Is it going to really make any difference if the Queen and when the Queen retires, as she said she plans to do?
Well, I think it's the most likely outcome is that Prince Charles is simply going to be the king. And, you know, that's what the rules say. And unless somebody has a heart attack, possibly Prince Charles, then that's what's going to happen.
And do you think he'd make a good king? Or, and if he's not, who else might take over?
Well, I'm not really that keen on having
a
king at all.
Sure, William, isn't it?
Well, I mean, the constitutional position is that we have a king or a queen if they're in line for the throne. And if we're not going to have a republic, and I cannot see that in any short term, even if Scotland votes for independence, they're likely to keep the queen as head of state. You know, the monarchy will limp on.
But it might be simply that William takes over and that, you know, which would be a great, you know, magnanimous thing for Charles to do. And Charles takes on this more international role with the World Economic Forum.
I don't think Charles
maybe
wants
to do both.
Yeah, I think Charles wants to be king. I mean, he's made that pretty clear over the years. So, I mean, in many ways, from the point of view of somebody who's not a mad monarchist, we just want the monarchy to not cause any problems, basically.
Okay, so let's go back to George Samueli now, because he is also author of a book on Yugoslavia and the Yugoslav breakup of Yugoslavia. Martin, you were over there, weren't you? This is one of those things that, for many people, I think, in this part of the world, Yugoslavia, people scratch their heads. What happened there? George has really done, I think, an excellent job of just pulling it all apart and also saying why it was so important. Because Yugoslavia was effectively a different model to the Soviet Union. Tito's Yugoslavia was somewhere kind of, you know, with his own Yugoslav constitution, was somewhere in between the communism and capitalism, wasn't it?
Well, it was definitely a unique setup, and
an example to other parts.
Well,
of the world?
To some extent, yes. But
they got into all sorts of debt. But I mean, it was supposed to be, and people I've spoken to said it was actually a really nice place to live. Obviously, the weather's good, but people had a feeling that they were workers participating in their factories, for example, this sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, picking up on that, the Yugoslav self-management system was obviously of great interest around the world. How does it work? You know, what's that about? And I even wrote a paper about it when I was working for New Economics Foundation, because in actual fact, it was not necessarily as brilliant as the propaganda in favour of it suggested.
So were NATO right to take it down?
No. I'm not suggesting that for a moment. I'm just trying to, if we're going to actually discuss Yugoslavia, let's talk about Yugoslavia before it broke down. The self-management system, which was rather unique and didn't really operate anywhere else in Eastern Europe or anywhere else, what it led to was a situation where workers in enterprises were given the power to decide whether they were going to have higher wages or more investment in the enterprise. Now, since most people were not going to, that led to a tendency for people to vote for higher wages now and not to invest in the future of the enterprise, because they're going to leave the enterprise at some point. Yeah, at some point they're going to retire, and therefore what they want to do is.
But they could do. There
tech.
Are other things, weren't there? Like, for example, people could actually elect their bosses.
Oh yes. So in other words, these were interesting experiments. But what was fundamentally flawed in the Yugoslav self-management system is the point I'm just making.
Well, what about any successes? Anything you point to and say, well, actually, that kind of did work?
Well, what?
Because it was pretty much a socialist era. Karl Marx, would he still been around, would have looked at that and he thought, oh, this is an interesting place.
Yes, and that's why it was interesting. But the problem with it, as I've just explained, is that if you've got people who leave the enterprise and they're no longer part of that enterprise, it becomes in their interest to try
and that's just one aspect.
Well, it is, but
anyway,
it's a rather important aspect, because what it then leads to is that enterprises are mismanaged. Now, if you compare it with the Mondragon system in the Basque region, in the Mondragon system, which is a self-managed system, you basically leave with a pension from the Enterprise. And that pension will be dependent upon the success of the Enterprise, which leads to workers having a genuine stake in the Enterprise.
In the long term. It's ever so difficult to get people to think long term. You know, we need to get systems like that where, you know, which actually induces you to say, well, you know, it makes sense to do things in the long term rather than.
That's right. Well, that was the problem. That was the problem with the self-management system. And then that was then papered over by printing money and borrowing money from the West. And then, of course, you've got yourself into a situation where the West can then pull the plug,
certainly
which is what they did.
Talking to people who lived in the former Yugoslavia, they were people I spoke to when I was on holiday over there a few years ago, who could speak English, were actually looking back with, you know, oh yes, those were the days, and now everything's been privatised and sold off. It's absolutely horrific. You know, there are things like massive private beaches everywhere you go, and you get a little square on the beach which has not been privatised, and a massive part of the beach with some guard standing there with nobody on the beach. This idea of privatising everything, it was obviously hasn't gone down too well there. Anyway, let's have a listen now to George talking about the Kosovo Liberation Army and their role, because you were involved a bit in that, Martin, weren't you? Can you just say something about that?
Well,
meeting people from
I never met anybody from the KLA.
Well, who then?
I basically arranged.
You were working for.
I was working for the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development, and I had contacts with people in Kosovo, Adam Demachi, who is not Hassim Thaci, who is now going to The Hague to stand trial for war crimes. He's Kosovo Liberation Army.
Milosevic, he went to the former Yugoslavia court, and he looked like he was winning, and then suddenly he was poisoned in his cell.
Well, that's what's alleged, and of course he never was convicted of anything in the end. The situation in Yugoslavia today is still extremely difficult and tense. Many people are much worse off than they were before the war. The failings of Yugoslav socialism were as nothing to the mess that's now been created.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think it was a success in many ways, and that's why it had to be stamped on. But also this other final aspect to all of this, which I'll put a long version of this interview up on thisweek.org.uk, the complete version, is because this whole idea of the Balkans has been used, hasn't it, in the Middle East, the idea of Balkanizing the Middle East to basically break it up and use it as a way to, you know, for the West, and particularly the United States and NATO and Israel, to take power over the countries around them.
Well, the whole term Balkanization is essentially racist. What it's been the unfortunate fate of the people who live in what is the Balkans for other people to come and settle their scores there. So they've been the Ottomans, the Russian Empire, the Western powers, the Austro-Hungarians, the Americans and the British. Everybody settles their scores in the Balkans, okay, and then blames the people who live there as if they're the problem.
Anyway, George has, I think, done a great job with his book on the former Yugoslavia and the conflict, explaining things. But here he does it in a nutshell, really. Explains also the role of Kosovo and the Kosovo Liberation Army in that conflict, as well as the strange death or assassination of Slobodan Milosevic by the courts, the NATO courts.
The Kosovo Liberation Army, the KLA, was clearly being funded, trained, armed by the CIA, German intelligence, it was being used largely. I mean, it's not that that NATO really cared, you know, too very much about the independence of Kosovo. They wanted to get at the leader of Serbia. They wanted Milosevic. Milosevic was really the last kind of socialist leader in Europe, somebody who had no time for NATO, somebody who had no time for the kind of neoliberal New World Order that was being organized by the United States and its NATO allies, and they wanted him out. They used the KLA, they used the sort of the issue of Kosovo to try to get him out of power. I mean, they've been explicit about it. I mean, they really made no secret of it, and many of the people who were involved in that war in 99 have admitted that their goal all along was to try to get Milosevic out. I mean, it was the first of the regime change operations. But of course, in terms of the actual conflict, the KLA proved to be a complete dud, which often happens when you basically are run by outside powers. They lost the war very quickly. I mean, the Serbs were, you know, easily defeated them. What won the war, to the extent that you can call it a victory, what won it for NATO was essentially their threat to bomb Belgrade, bomb Serbia back into the Stone Age. And they were going to do it because, if you remember, the bombing campaign was going on week after week after week, and Madeleine Albright, the U.S. Secretary of State at the time, had promised, oh, that Serbia would cave within 72 hours. It would only go on for a few days. And so as the bombing went on and the Serbs under Milosevic refused to cave, there was a certain amount of panic that was setting in Washington and in London. What is going to happen? How are we going to deal with this? And there were already protests being mounted in the streets of Europe, particularly Europe, in London, but also in Germany. They were getting fed up with this. I mean, you know, however bad the Serbs are supposed to be, of course, I don't think the Serbs were bad, but at least most people at least bought into the media claptrap about the Serbs. But however bad they are, you can't justify actually bombing a small country week after week after week. And so really, the only thing NATO could do is, I mean, they'd run out of military or strategic targets to bomb. It was really just to go for civilian bombing, basically just level the country. And this was the threat that they made to Milosevic. They said, we're going to do this. We're going to just destroy the entire country. I don't know whether they would have actually gone ahead with that, but you can understand why, you know, if you're the president of Serbia, you might take the decision that I can't take the risk of having my entire country, you know, the capital of my country, just leveled by these NATO barbarians. And so Milosevic kind of eventually gave in. But on the sort of the key issues on which NATO had insisted, in fact, Milosevic hadn't given in. He hadn't given in on NATO occupying force within Serbia, NATO occupying force in Kosovo, because in fact NATO had to go to the UN Security Council and had to agree to a United Nations force within Kosovo. So NATO was just planning. Well, Madeleine Albright of the Clinton administration just simply wanted a NATO force up right in there in Kosovo. That's it. Just NATO, nothing else. But, you know, they actually had to go to the UN Security Council and get a UN force to go into Kosovo. And so you know, Milosevic achieved some things, I mean, through by holding out for during this bombing. But, of course, you know, NATO, of course, broke its word because, as I say, they had promised that secession was off the table. No, we're not going to stand by and allow Kosovo to secede. But of course, they did. That's par for the course for NATO.
What about Milosevic, though? Because there are, I mean, there's quite a lot of, in fact, I've interviewed a couple of people over the years that have said that they believe that the evidence is very strong, that he was actually poisoned at the International Criminal Court because he was starting to do reasonably well in his case, right, and then he dropped dead in his cell.
Well, it's a very, you know, who knows, because, you know, they rushed the autopsy and then they rushed to bury him. So on the face of it, it was very suspicious. Now, if you look back on what happened during the last 2 weeks of his life, he had applied to go to Russia for treatment for his heart condition. The tribunal had rejected his request, but no particularly good reason, because they said, oh, well, we have no faith that he will actually come back, even though the Russian government had guaranteed that they would return him. But nonetheless, they said no. So this was about 2 weeks before he actually died. So they denied him the medical treatment. But then what was very interesting is that they had a blood test that was done on him, and then at the tribunal, and the tribunal said, oh, we found this thing called rifampicin in your blood. And now rifampicin is a kind of an anti-leprosy drug. And so this is, you know, Milosevic then, you know, got very anxious. wrote to the Russians, Russian foreign minister, saying, "Hey, look, I think they're trying to kill me." And then, of course, he died very soon after that. Now, this is all very embarrassing for the tribunal. So then they came up with a story. Well, yes, we found the rifampicin in his blood, but he was doing it himself. He was administering this rifampicin to himself in order to elevate his blood pressure, in order that we would agree to his being sent to Russia for treatment for his heart condition. Of course, there had absolutely no evidence whatsoever that he was administering rifampicin himself. I mean, where would he get the rifampicin? It's a rare drug. They had no evidence, but they threw out this accusation because they had no choice. I mean, they're the ones who found the rifampicin. He's the one who reported it to the Russian foreign ministry. So then they had to say, oh, yeah, you did it yourself. But of course, when they did the autopsy after his death, then they said, oh, no, there is no rifampicin in his blood. It was a very, very strange event. And of course, you know, as always happens with the tribunal, the ICTY, it investigated itself. No one outside of the ICTY investigated what went on there, because the ICTY is a creation of the United Nations. It has diplomatic immunity, and it's basically just a law unto itself. And so, of course, when it wrote its report about Milosevic's death, they said, no, it's all his fault. You know, we provided him with the best possible medical care, and he kind of did it all to himself. So we're good to go. We didn't do anything.
So Milosevic got himself a chapter in the Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy.
Exactly.
The analysis there is pretty good. The Serbs were certainly not innocent, in my experience. But on the other hand, the presentation of what happened in Yugoslavia was extremely partial, and the complexities of it were not really well understood by the outside world.
And well, that's deliberate, isn't it? I think a lot of the time the idea is to make sure that people don't really understand what's going on there, especially when their own taxpayers' money is being used to overthrow the government.
Yeah, and I think with hindsight as well, when I was working there in the 90s, I was in my 30s, and I remember talking to a former Bulgarian foreign minister in Sofia, and we pretty much shared George Samueli's analysis of what was going on, and this guy said to me, "Well, you do realise that the Americans have done this deliberately, that they've deliberately created a war in Yugoslavia." And I didn't want to accept that at the time. I thought they'd made a terrible mess, and that they'd definitely done loads of things wrong, but I just presumed it was incompetence. But looking back from what is now becoming my old age, and also with subsequent things that happened, like the invasion of Iraq, etc., it becomes, and then 9/11 and so on, it becomes fairly clear that there was a determination to create a war in Yugoslavia for their own purposes. And it comes back to what I was saying earlier about the Balkans being seen as this kind of mad territory full of mad people who kind of can't get on with each other. But the real tragedy of the region is that outside forces use it as a place to settle scores with their enemies, and the local people end up being literally the shit in the sandwich.
So that interview with George Samueli, I'll put up on our show page a complete version of it. It's probably something like half an hour or 40 minutes altogether. He is the author of the book is Bombs for Peace, NATO's Humanitarian War on Yugoslavia. Bit of a tongue-in-cheek title there. In the late 1990s, NATO dropped bombs and supported armed insurgencies in Yugoslavia, insisting its motives were purely humanitarian. George Samueli, Samueli, and he was speaking to me from Eastern Europe. Martin, now, The Traitors of Arnhem last week, published as a PDF online. This week, another book of mine. Also, it's a bit frustrating, you know, being commissioned to write books, as I was in this case with this one called The Siege of Heaven by Trani Day Books, then sending it to them and saying, we're not going to publish this yet, we may be publishing it, and even getting paid to do it, and then finding it still not appearing in print. So I think, you know, it may be the time to do this. But it's basically just a collection of my articles over the years, much of which were from RT. I did a long series of articles from RT, but I've done quite a lot since. And it's finishing up really with some writing I've done on the English Civil War and the procedure around Oliver Cromwell and the execution of Charles II, and looking at some of the shenanigans that were going on. Because Cromwell was in a bit of a difficult situation. I think we just maybe just look at this one, Martin. He was in a difficult situation in the Civil War, wasn't he? In that the Parliament wanted to vote to negotiate with the King in 1648, 1649, and Cromwell wasn't going to be allowing that, was he? Because he knew that if the King survived the war, the King would be coming for him, and maybe for his head.
Well, there's an awful lot to say about the English Civil War, or the War of the Three Kingdoms, as it's now called in historical.
Oh dear, is it? They're always trying to change the name of things.
Well, that's because a lot of the people who died in Ireland, for example. So it wasn't the English Civil War.
But
they weren't
fighting in the English Civil War.
No,
that was a consequence of it.
Yeah, but the war was fought all through the Three Kingdoms, England and Wales. Scotland is where it began, of course. With the rebellion against the prayer book.
Well, no, it began in London, and it began in Newark.
No, it began, well, the war had already begun with the rebellion against the prayer book and the Covenanters in Scotland, and then their invasion of England and so on. But anyway, Cromwell was in, all revolutionaries are in a difficult position. And of course, what ultimately did for Charles I was he was pretending to negotiate with his parliamentary opponents, but secretly he was negotiating with others, and the Irish rebels in particular, to restore his full power. And of course,
There were quite a few parliamentarians, quite a few MPs that were thinking, well, actually, well, now this is all over. We can just change the arrangement between Parliament and Charles, and he can just come back and carry on being king.
Yes, and the reason they couldn't do that is because he was determined not to have a negotiated solution. He was pretending to negotiate at the same time as secretly negotiating, particularly with the Irish.
So you're
rebels.
A Cromwellite in this case.
It's hard to say whose side one would have been on if one was there at the time. It would depend who one was, wouldn't it? Ultimately, they were put in a position where if they didn't, one of the parliamentarians, the earlier stages of the Civil War, said, we can win every battle, but if we lose one battle, we will be wiped out, you know, we will be traitors. He can lose every battle, but he only has to win one, and then we'll all hang. So we're not in a position, really, to take a risk with it.
But the thing is, the King did win some battles, didn't he? He just didn't win the war.
Well, indeed, and that's why he ended up losing his head.
I think Edmund Ludlow is a fascinating figure. I don't know if you know much about him, but he was on the parliamentary side right the way through until it came to the end game. And he said, well, look, we really, you know, we should be negotiating with the King here. And he left the parliament. In fact, you know, he left the parliamentary side. And, of course, there was a purge of parliament, wasn't there? So that Cromwell made sure that the only people left in parliament were going to be voting for the trial of the King for his execution.
Yes. I mean, you know, we could go, I mean, this isn't really current politics, is it? But I mean, all of these things are part of the history of the country.
We're not talking about current politics now. We're really talking about history and the way that history has been massaged. Because actually, the English Civil War was an immensely important, it put the bedrock together for what became the British Empire.
It did, and it also created the possibility of the American Revolution, and both the English Revolution and the American Revolution created the possibility of the French Revolution, which then led to the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, and the Yugoslav Revolution.
And I think what you might be more interested, though, Martin, is my article, some of my articles, I mean, you may have even seen them yourself, or you probably know this stuff, because we talk about it on here quite a lot, is the Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy. One of the people that comes up in that is the former Labour Foreign Secretary who resigned in the run-up to the Iraq War, Robin Cook.
Yes. What about him?
Do you think he was assassinated?
Quite possibly.
Is it possible?
Yep. I mean, his wife, Gillian, put on his tombstone, he was able to get the war debated in Parliament, but he was unable to stop it. So I think she was very convinced that in actual fact his death was not natural. And if you think about it, he had a funny turn on a mountain when he was walking with his wife. They were both, he was conscious. They had a mobile phone. They phoned for help. And normally they would send the you know, the rescue helicopter. But when they got through to the 999, they were told, as it happens, we've got a military exercise going on the other side of the mountain. We will send a military helicopter to take him away. So 2 minutes later, a military helicopter
amazing.
Turns
up. It's amazing that the ambulance service knows that, isn't it?
It's a bit of a coincidence, isn't it? Anyway, she attempted to get into the helicopter with her husband. Then they said, oh, there's no room for you. You've got to walk back down the mountain. And he said, don't worry, I'll go with these people. And off he went. But he was dead on arrival at Inverness, and also, she had to walk home. She wasn't happy.
The local Labour Party, I think it was Ben Stack, where he was taken away by the helicopter of death, a bit like Diana and the ambulance of death. And the local Labour Party there, Martin, put up a monument on the spot where he was taken away, the helicopter. But there was some local authority, local council people who were, I don't know what party or whatever they were, but they decided, no, you've done this without permission. And they actually took the trouble to go up the mountain with diggers and things like that and actually dig the monument out and destroy it.
Yeah, well, the motive, if there was a motive for killing him, was that he quite likely, if at the end of the Gulf War, you know, the Iraq War, and Tony Blair could have been unseated by Cook. And he was definitely regarded as a threat.
He could have been possibly even, you could even say, a shoe in to replace Blair instead of Brown.
Absolutely, but not if he's dead.
No. Not anyway, so that's just one article. It's called The Assassin's Guide to Western Democracy, and it's in this book I published as a PDF today called The Siege of Heaven. My second book I've published in 2 weeks, because these are books that have been sitting there, and the publishers have just sort of either not managed to actually put them into print or whatever, even though asking for them in the first place. So let's go on now to look at this... CIA and Britain's Invisible Empire, because this is Anton Chaikin here, a look at the origins of Pentecostalism and the charismatic movement and the mind control programs of the CIA and the Tavistock Institute. The reason I'm dropping this in is because The Siege of Heaven is really about this attempt to destroy organized faith, organized religion and organized spirituality, rather like we were talking about in the first part with our three guests.
I'm going to show you a book. This is the cover of the book. It's called The Battle for the Mind. And on the cover, right above that, you might be able to read, The Mechanics of Indoctrination, Brainwashing, and Thought Control. This book was published in 1957 when they were gearing this thing up. Dr. William Sargent was a psychiatrist with the Tavistock Institute, and probably more important for your consideration, he has a career on the staff of Maudsley Hospital in England, which is the British center for what is known as eugenic psychiatry or psychiatric eugenics. This was the methodology and the pretext for starting the T4 organization under Adolf Hitler, and it was managed by the British, by this group of people who spread Pentecostalism into the United States. The United States military began thinking along the lines of needing indoctrination, brainwashing, and thought control, at least a current among them, a very important current, after Douglas MacArthur was fired. We need mind war. We don't need nations that produce steel. We need terror bombing. We need psychological warfare. We need computer games. This is from the book. Here you see people being put into voodoo trances and possession. You have three photographs here of pagans, quote, pagans, unquote. You see people in Bali. He says, technique used in Bali makes worshippers believe they are possessed by the spirits of monkeys. Now, Harold Bredesen writes in a recent article in Charisma magazine, remember, this is the magician preacher that captured Haynes and who trained Pat Robertson. Bredesen says, the way demons operate, unclean spirits come into a medium, violate her personality, and speak through her. But rest assured that what we're doing is different. The Holy Spirit doesn't want mediums, robots, or zombies. He instructs you how to speak in tongues. Don't speak words your mind understands. As long as you do, your mind will remain in control. Same book. Now we got Christians. The last one was pagans. Now we have, quote, Christians, unquote, being studied by the British psychiatrists. While they're doing this, while they're making this thing up for Americans to follow. Terminal exhaustion, states of acute excitement leading to the final phase of total collapse, are purposefully worked for in potential converts during religious snake handling. All phenomena are explained as the work of the Holy Ghost.
So that's Anton Chaikin there, part of a much longer talk, Britain's Invisible Empire, looking at Pentecostalism and the charismatic movement as basically, Martin, a kind of offshoot of the CIA.
Well, obviously, Pentecostalism and charismatic Christianity are older than the CIA, but nevertheless, they certainly have weaponized Pentecostalism. Bolsonaro, for example, and in Brazil, the CIA have been very involved in pushing Pentecostalism as a way of undermining the liberation theology posture of some elements of the Brazilian church. And you've got Reverend Myung Moon in South Korea. You've got very conservative Pentecostalist Christians in South Korea, and they're very, very much in the pocket of the South Korean CIA, which is in the pocket of the US CIA. So they've got their fingers in all sorts of
places. Fascinating talk, actually, that is, Anton Chaikin. Just to remind you, he is the son of Jacob Chaikin, who was the chief strategist and lawyer for the American Jewish Nazi Boycott Committee in the run-up to the Second World War, who, by the way, were sort of outflanked by the Zionists, weren't they? The Zionists actually started trading and decided to break that boycott, much to the annoyance of Anton Chaikin's father, Jacob, and the rest of those people part of that boycott committee.
Yeah, well, I mean, this brings us back to the whole row about anti-Semitism and the Labour Party, because it was making comments about the relationship between the Nazis and the Zionists, which led to the expulsion or ultimately resignation of Ken Livingstone.
Well, Ken Livingstone was accused of saying that Hitler was a Zionist, but he didn't actually say that.
No.
What did he say?
He said that there were cooperation.
No, he said that Hitler supported Zionism.
Yes.
And actually, he did support it because he was doing deals with them. And the Zionists were enabling many Jews to be taken out of Germany. So Hitler rather liked that. And they were going over to Palestine.
There is...
it's called the transfer agreement.
Yeah, well, there was actually an agreement between the Nazi regime and elements of the Zionist movement. And they even sent out, I've got a History Today article about it, which came out from the 70s, I think. And they even sent a scoping mission to Palestine, which had an SS officer and a Zionist official. And they even issued a commemorative medal with a swastika on one side and a Star of David on the other. This is all historical fact. The Zionists like to pretend that they were the opposition to Hitler. But during the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, which was organised by the Jewish Socialist Bund, mostly, the Zionists were only brought into the conspiracy at the very end because they were not trusted by the Jewish Socialist insurrectionists.
I mean, Anton mentioned briefly there the Nazi T4 programme, which he says was put together by the British, the Tavistock Institute and the Maudsley Hospital. This is a Nazi German effort framed as a euthanasia program to kill incurably ill, physically or mentally disabled and emotionally distraught and elderly people. There's echoes of this still today, isn't there, in Bill Gates' eugenics programs?
Well, the similarities with all of these reactionary movements, isn't there? And the Zionist movement was a reactionary nationalist movement, not dissimilar to Italian fascism. And the Jabotinskyite right wing in Israel modelled themselves on the black shirts, which Mussolini's black shirts.
Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Martin Summers, and also to our guests in the first part, that's Kate, Julie and Delia. talking about the mainly really about the demonstration on College Green tomorrow, which is being organised by something called Stand Up X, although I don't know if it's organised by anyone specific. They've asked me to talk, but I'm not clear that there's going to be any opportunity to talk, because the police have said that they're going to make sure that the demonstration, however socially distanced it is, doesn't happen. So thanks to Martin, to Kate, to Julie and Delia. Also thanks to our studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. This show is broadcast at 9 and midnight Friday on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch in two places, from noon at richieallen.co.uk and on Camberley's radioqUK.com. Also, you'll be able to pick up Richie Allen most Fridays, it seems now, from 3 o'clock on this stream, and he will be handing over to us at 5. On Fridays, feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like. I just request you credit the show to thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
And ITT and AT. Pumped down. Union carbide. Well, they certainly don't hedge their bets. I urge you to try and track down their recordings, if you've not already done so, and give them a serious listen. That's Consolidated, the last from them tonight, obviously. America Number One is the title of it.